We will call the Game and Fish Forestry Division to order. A quorum is present on February the 26th, 2007. So the first, do we have the minutes from the last meeting? Representative Hansen moves the minutes of the February 19th meeting. Any discussion on the motion? Being none, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Minutes are adopted. All right, the first, because of our the fun and games we had today on the House floor, Representative Solberg headed to down to Rochester, and so I'm going to move Representative Solberg's bill, which is House File 1035, and that has to do with Minnesota Steel and Iron and some land that they need to have some assistance with to for one reason is financial assurances, and I'm going to have to present the bill. Former Senator Ron Dicklich come before the committee and present the bill. So, Senator Dicklich, could you say your name and who you represent on this bill?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ron Dicklich. I'm with Itasca County. And House File 1035 is presented.
Dicklich, there is an amendment we should adopt to get this in the form that Representative Solberg wanted. It's the 0117 amendment. Do members have that amendment? Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended, Senator Dicklich.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, now the bill does two things. The first one, I'll address the amendment. And what that does, it allows Itasca County to lease the tax part for the land to Minnesota Steel for a period of 20 years. Currently under state statute, you're only allowed to make that type of lease for 10 years. And this gets a little complicated because you have three things going on here. First of all, there was land that was owned by the Blandon Paper Company, which is now UPM Kumada, and this land was in and around where the mining of taconite that will go to make the steel in this steel project. And so they exchanged, Itasca County had some land, exchanged that land with Blandon on a dollar basis, I believe that's the way it's done, but on a dollar basis or value basis. And then Itasca County is going to take that land and lease slash sell the land that they acquired from Blandon to Minnesota Steel so that they can have the land for both mining or in the mining peripheral area and lands that they need to have a legal industrial mining setup for that would have a mine, taconite plant, DRI, and a steel plant. And so the first the amendment you just put on is for 20 years, and the reason this has to take place is they're financing this. They have $500 million cash. It's $1.6 billion, and they're going to be financing about $1.1 billion. And according to the lenders, the financial institutions, since they have a 20-year mine plan, they need to have a lease that coincides with their mine plan to assure that the payback will not be interrupted. So you can't have a 12 or 15 or 16-year payback and not say that you have control of it. You say that you only have control of that land for 10 years. Now, granted, these are usually just automatic renewals. However, for the financial institution, for the amounts of money they're talking about here, that isn't good enough. So it's on the amendment. And I'm going to apologize for the next one because Representative Solberg explained it briefly to me before he left. And what I understand is that this is to prevent a double payment of the for the land for the 3% of the sales price for this to happen twice. And maybe Senate House Counsel can help me here about what this is designed to do.
Well, I think it was explained to me that normally the cost of title insurance is included in the net
right.
amount of the exchange, the land plus any cash. And in this instance, it was not included in that. Right. And so the Second Amendment would provide for that. There's also a $180,000 fiscal note on that, of which I do not know, members, where that. I know it's not general fund,
right.
But I do not know where that $180,000 figure, where it actually comes from, what fund. maybe, you know, Mr. Meyer could tell us, or someone from Lands and Minerals if they're in the audience. I think we need to find that. Oh, okay, very good. I knew someone would help us out. Hi there. Introduce yourself for the record, and then if you can answer the question.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis with the Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. The payment of the fund is under the requirement that when you sell tax forfeited land, 3% of the sale proceeds goes into this fund, and it is part of the general fund, and it is used to pay claims for people who say they have been unjustly deprived of their land due to errors made in the tax forfeiture process. I believe in looking at this bill that one of the reasons for this provision is that these lands that are involved were actually lands owned by Blanding Company, and they were exchanged with tax forfeited lands. And so what is really becoming tax forfeited lands were Blanding lands. As part of the land exchange, which was approved by the Land Exchange Board in December, there had to be title commitments prepared, and the titles were reviewed both by the Itasca County Attorney's Office and by the Attorney General's Office, and so they determined that they were marketable titles. So it is very unlikely there would be any claims brought against this group of lands.
Okay, thank you. Questions by Ms. Lewis, by the members? Okay. Questions? Okay. Senator Dicklich? Anything else? Any questions on the bill? Representative Simpson.
Thank you. Senator, the township apparently is okay with this. It looks like it's ordered on annexation, so are they in agreement with doing this? That's my question.
I'm missing...
I mean, Representative Simpson, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The question I ask is the township okay with this, or is it, it sounds like the city is in favor of it, of course, because they're going to take the property in, and they say it's orderly annexation, so is the township okay with this, or is there any correspondence between the township and us on this?
I do not know, but I do not, Senator Dicklich, is there, are the townships in support of the project?
Well,
yeah, I'm sure they are. Representative Manziel, can you come forward and answer that question?
These lands are in the township.
And I'm not sure that they're in the township.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, this project is in my house district, and the answer to the question is yes, peace in the valley, townships, the municipality, everybody in agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I missed at the beginning what your motion for the bill was going to be. Are we going to hold this bill over? Is it going to be part of a lands bill? Or
We're sending it. The motion presently is to send it to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it eventually going to be part of the lands bill, or is your intent that this is going to travel alone by itself? Usually these things are with the lands bill, Mr. Chairman, and the DNR scrutinizes all these pretty well. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what the intent is for this bill.
Well, I think that my intent would be to include it in the lands bill. I haven't discussed that point with Representative Solberg, so that's the best answer I can give you at the moment. And I'm sure he would have a position on that one way or the other.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend that it is included with the lands bill, and that the DNR, scrutinize it like all the other tax forfeited land pieces, and hopefully we'll see it again.
Yeah, can Ms. Lewis come back up? Yeah, Ms. Lewis, have you scrutinized the bill already and reviewed the bill, and does the department have any problem with the bill as you understand the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department has reviewed the bill, and we have no issues with the bill. We've been very active in this project, and we understand it's just another one of the last phases of getting this project put together.
So that bill then, Representative Hackbarth, would meet the custom and usage of this house in having the DNR approving bills before they were incorporated into the lands bill. So really that opens the door to do it either way. Send it alone on its own, or to include it and incorporate it in the in the lands bill. Senator Dinklage, is there any urgency on this? Do the financial assurances that this provides to the financiers, does this have any urgency? So if the land bill didn't pass till the end of session, does that hamper the project at all?
Yep, Mr. Chairman, absolutely. They're working on the financial package right now and hope to have financial close by June. And if something happens that didn't pass, they wouldn't have their financial close. They're scheduled to start construction sometime after permitting, which they're projecting in sometime August or September, and then they have a 2-year construction period, so it would put them out of hole.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that and I can appreciate that, but as you know, that a lot of these land bills can be controversial when they get to the floor. People have amendments for different bills. They haven't been approved by the different parcels, haven't been approved by the DNR, but that sort of thing. Usually when we put a package together for the lands bill, they've all been approved. It's all in one package. Everybody understands that. I'm just worried that if you bring one lands bill forward and you're going to pass that on its own, might be subject to some amendments on the floor, then you're going to have another one. Just allows for a little confusion. To me, that's the way I see it, Mr. Chairman. We might have tons of amendments for this and then more amendments later. I don't want to see that happen.
All right, Representative Hackbarth, duly noted your concern on this, and we'll go ahead with the motion as stated, and we'll take a look at that in between stops here.
I don't have a problem with the bill, Mr. Chairman. I can blow it out here.
Okay, anyone here to testify for or against the bill? There being none, any further discussion by the members on the bill as amended? Being none, I'll renew my motion on House File 1035 as amended, recommend to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you very much. Ms. Lewis, would it be possible to send a letter to us, to my committee, since we're handling the lands bill, that you approve of this, so we have it in the file? So if we incorporate it in the lands bill, we won't have to cross that bridge again.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, just one moment. The agenda has Representative Anzell's bill up next, which is the forestry bill, and I'm going to delay that because we've got people here that travel down for a 4 o'clock hearing from, at the very least, Grand Marais. And I'd like them to get out and get some supper. I don't know if they're headed home. And then we have Representative Heigerken's bill. I think you've had some people that traveled in on that as well. So with that, we'll take up Representative Heigerken's bill, which is House File 191.
Chairman?
Representative Ackbarth.
I would move House File 191 to bring it before the committee. Be recommended to pass. Are you considering holding it over for a possible inclusion in the Game and Fish bill?
That is correct.
That would be my motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so we have Representative Hackbarth moves that the House File 191 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Representative Heigerken, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's an honor to be here. It's the first time ever in your committee and in any environment committee. But in front of you is a very simple bill, changing it from one line to two line. And Representative Hackbarth has an oral amendment that he'd like to make at this time.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To get the bill in the shape that the author would like, we'd like to delete Subdivision 2.
All right. The motion before us, we're getting the bill out here out of the stack. We're not doing them in order, so it takes a second. So the intent of the motion, Representative Hackbarth, is to, if the bill were to pass as amended, if we amend it, it would be two lines with one hook on each line. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman. We believe that this language might allow for two lines
in multiple hooks
in different spots on the line, and that's not the intent.
All right. Discussion on the Hackbarth amendment to House File 191. Representative Cornish.
Direct Representative Hackbarth, I was just wondering if, are we deleting Subdivision 2?
Correct.
The problem I have is we're not just deleting the changes, we're deleting all the language, and that language is in law now.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not deleting that language from law.
Oh, okay.
I'm just deleting that from the bill.
Sounds good.
Just the changes in Subdivision.
Correct.
Okay, so the motion, members, is to delete the changes as in the proposed bill, House File 191, in Subdivision 2. Discussion on the Hackbarth motion to amend. Being none, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. All right. Representative Heigerken to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in front of you are a number of handouts, and we're going to be very quick here. I know you got a couple other bills up here. And perhaps the best one written is by Gary Roach from the Outdoor News. Two lines are not two lines. And refers to the argumentation there of what the idea behind fishing. And basically, in the middle of the page, he asks, why not? And then the most important part of fishing is finding fish. And it goes on and explains why and the arguments against it. And we'll touch upon them. I'm sure some members will have some questions in regards to this. Other states have done it. All of the states around us have either two or three lines. Some of the argumentation is that perhaps if this was allowed, that we would over-harvest lakes. And one of the arguments there is if you do find fish, obviously you can only catch so many fish. The limits stay the same. And instead of catching a fish in 2 hours, you probably catch it 1.5 hours. The other argument is brought up in the that same page there in regards to over-harvesting. And again, the argument on that is that when you look what the other states have done, the fishing has improved in the quota reservoirs and the quota lakes. So the argument there is, again, you can go back and forth. And Gary does a very good job of his argument is that the idea is to fish. Another good letter there in your handout is by L. Linder. You should have that. And I'm just going to read two lines from his letter. You can read the rest of them yourself. Today we have catch and release, slot limits, bag limits, and other regulations based on environmental assessments. Yet Minnesota's one rod per person rule does not address today's realities. While traveling all over North America, filming in every state in the union, we found no rational reason for not permitting the use of two rods per person. And again, there's some other handouts in front of you that refer to polls down as much as high as 70% in favor. We were hoping to have Al Linder here as one of the testifiers, but I believe he is in the... he's down in Florida, and he's tied up down there. But today I do have... I had Pete Harsh was supposed to be here testifying from professional fishermen, but he had to cancel because of the sickness in the family. But I have Jim Kokoban from In Fisherman, and that some of you have heard that In Fisherman program on many radio stations. I know it's carried on Chasm back home on Friday mornings. But anyways, it's a very, very good show. And I have another young man, Chuck Barth, from my district, that kind of taught me into doing this bill, and I've had nothing but good response at home in regards to this bill. So with that said, I'll introduce Jim.
Welcome. And if you'll say your name and who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. We'll slide over here a little bit.
Thank you for staying around until this hour.
Well, thank you. I had prepared a few minutes worth of comments, and my first two words were good afternoon. I'll have to strike that.
Well, as you can see from our display on the House floor, less is more.
We were listening to that. My name is Jim Kalkofen, and to briefly introduce myself, I've been in the fishing tackle and marine industry for 30 years, the past 16 as executive director of the In Fisherman Professional Walleye Trail located in Brainerd. I've fished in more than half the states in that time and lots of Canadian waters. Each year I hold a dozen state licenses and a whole bunch of provincial fishing licenses, but that's not important to you. What's important is that what I do is with the PWT, the Professional Walleye Trail, is to promote walleye fishing through a series of competitive fishing events. These events are pro-am in nature, and we've been from New York to Montana, from the Canadian border in Minnesota and Michigan, all the way to Kentucky. This year we'll also be in Ontario for the first time ever. But my purpose here is to share my observations of that fishing. You know, and because it's my job, I get to observe it a little more closely than if it was just my personal passion. Oh, wait, it's both. First of all, and this is recognized as a fact in the fishing community, there are more walleye swimming today in North America than any point in history. The efforts to clean up the environment have produced tremendous results in the traditional walleye range. The Great Lakes and the many reservoirs in the Mid-South and the Western states are teeming with walleyes. But I don't want to just spend all my time on walleyes, even though that is like the state fish here in Minnesota. I want you to know that in all the other states where walleyes are thriving, anglers can fish for them with two or more lines. That is the case in all the states bordering Minnesota, to reiterate what Bud said. Second of all, some of the most highly rated fisheries in states around us include the Missouri River system in North and South Dakota. In Wisconsin, their walleye factory is called Lake Winnebago, and they have Green Bay, a magnificent part of Lake Michigan, loaded with walleyes. Here in Minnesota, the two hottest walleye lakes are Red Lake and Mille Lacs. Tremendous fisheries abound throughout the upper Midwest. Fish populations can be governed by laws that limit when people can fish and how many they can keep each day and how many they can possess. States may set lake-by-lake regulations, which the biologists would like to do, or manage them with a statewide law. The waters I talked about in Wisconsin and the Missouri River out west allow fishing 12 months of the year. That's a difference from Minnesota. Another difference is that the bag limits max out at 5 in each of these other states. Also, in Wisconsin, anglers may use up to 3 lines while fishing open water. In South and North Dakota, 2 lines in open water. Now I'd like to share an interesting conversation with you. While fishing in Arkansas about 10 years ago and getting ready for a PWT tournament down there, I visited with the local DNR warden. I asked him how many lines were allowed in his state. He gave me sort of a puzzled look and said, "Who cares?" And went on to say, "If you've got a dozen rods, you can hang them over the side." He said, "Just remember, I'm on the water, and you can still only catch a daily limit." I was sort of surprised at his answer at the time, but it got me to thinking. And sort of my third point of the day is fishing regulations, in most cases, are steeped in tradition. Change is often difficult because of these traditions. However, a neighboring state changed a major fishing law relating to the number of lines that an angler could use, and it was implemented with barely a whimper. In Wisconsin, and I was living there at the time, and I was active in the Conservation Congress and fishing organizations, the state law was 3 lines while ice fishing and 2 lines while open water fishing. In 1987, the regulations were changed to bring the number of lines in open water season into compliance and agreement with what was permitted while ice fishing. It was sort of a shrug of the shoulders by the collective fishing community. The next year, the 3-line rule went into effect in the Great Lakes. And the reason at the time was to make the law consistent season to season for law enforcement officials. Sort of a fourth point with that Wisconsin lesson in mind is that fly fishermen, musky casters, bass fishermen throwing spinnerbaits, or walleye anglers jigging will continue to fish with 1 line. No difference there. Anglers fish with the method they have learned and are best at, and I guess I'm no exception, and neither are you. Minnesota trollers with a 2-line rule would be able to experiment and find the right pattern of color, size, depth, speed with their fishing for. They still couldn't catch any more fish or catch them any quicker, but they would have the option of using another line. Same for slip bobber anglers here in the state. By going to a 2-line system in Minnesota, I feel you'll accomplish several main goals. You'll standardize the fishing regulations from winter to summer. Tourists coming from neighboring states, and they buy the most out-of-state licenses here, are familiar with multi-line fishing. You'll allow anglers to try other fishing methods where several lines prevail, which could reduce pressure on certain areas of the lake. For instance, if most anglers fish rock humps with slip bobbers and they've got 1 line out, maybe they might start trolling a couple lines if they could troll crankbaits in a deeper adjacent waters. And you might help fishing tackle sales in Minnesota as a few more anglers equip themselves for trolling or decide they need an extra rod or two. And just as a side note, every fisherman needs an extra rod or two. One thing you will not do is cause fishing folks to take more than their limit. That will remain the same. Or maybe the 6 walleye limit here in Minnesota may be lowered if fishery officials feel that's warranted. But that would be another tradition that, if changed, would not affect the numbers who fish. In Wisconsin, the walleye limit's 5, in North Dakota 5, in South Dakota 4. But the bag limit discussion is something for another day, another time, and more opinions. The issue before us today is to bring the number of lines in Minnesota's open water season into agreement with what's allowed now in winter. That number's two, and I strongly urge you to act accordingly to make that happen. Thank you, and are there any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions by the members? Yes, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this will be for the author, Representative Heidrich, and one of the other testifiers. It seems to me that last year in the Fish and Game Bill, we allowed for the DNR to, at their discretion, authorize two lines, and they've only done that in one instance. My first question is maybe you could respond to that, and then maybe we're going to get the agency up here. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we will.
Okay. And then when they can respond to that as well. And the second is, in the handout that you gave us, it shows that many other states, or several here, have allowed for a second line with a stamp. And I know our Fish and Game Fund isn't very flush. Have you considered that option?
Go ahead. Representative Heidrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to let my expert answer your question there, but I know you're coming from. Also, there's a handout there also that I didn't refer to, and that is that the number of licenses in the state of Minnesota has gone down over the last 10 and 20 years, even though the population has gone up 900,000. But with that, I'll ask Jim to answer that question.
Well, thank you. I've fished in some of those states where you can buy an extra stamp for an extra rod, is basically how people call it. One of the issues in some of those states has been with the warden force. They like to have everybody be the same out there, so that if Bud is jigging, he's got one line, there's no doubt that he's got a license. So when the warden checks his license or doesn't, because he knows him and says, okay, I'm going to go on to that weird guy out there trolling with four lines because he's got two people in the boat, now I have to check his license, look for a stamp, and do a lot more work. So I know it's, when I talk to the enforcement officials, they like stuff to be pretty simple there. But it is.
I'm sure they do.
I can see the dollar signs flashing in your head, and I understand the reasoning for the question.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. Dollar signs to me mean fish in the lake, though. You know, and so this is not money that we're going to squander away for anything. It's money that we're going to allow for improving the resource for you and other people who fish, and hopefully up in Weeks Lake or Cass Lake or Lake Bemidji.
I'll just tell you a story. When we first started tournaments of a nature where we were bringing anglers from all the states to fish team tournaments, it was amazing how much fun the Wisconsin guys had on the lacs on those first few tournaments during the practice time, until they were informed, oh, you can only run one line each. Huh? It was basically the attitude. So it was a learning curve by the visitors, and you'd have a lot more non-resident licenses sold, and you'd be in compliance for those people who are used to doing it. How many more people would fish more than one line? I can't answer that. But I know that there are opportunities and options where that would be a factor.
Well, with regard to the conservation officers having to do more, Representative Cornish, up in my area, we've got conservation officers check your birth certificate, your driver's license, everything you can imagine. So I don't see that as a problem. Representative Cornish, I had to shoot you a shot there.
Mr. Chairman, members, I have a problem with a lot of your testimony, but first of all, we don't want everybody to catch their limited fish. It seems like a funny statement to make, but if they did, we wouldn't have any fish in the lake. As a conservation officer for 22 years up north, I know Al Lindner, and I've checked his license before. And a lot of people to fish with him, and he's a good guy, but there's almost no magazine or fishing guide or fishing sport that doesn't always encourage more product being sold, more fish being taken. And when we went through depth finders, nobody saw a problem with that. Went through flashers, nobody saw a problem. Videograph, finally video cameras, every advancement everybody loves, because it's more jobs, more money and tourism, this and that, but sometimes we forget about the fish. And when you're out there on the lake, and I don't know what the DNR will say about this, but they've got things figured out somewhat on a formula that the time you're out there fishing per fish caught. And I've seen it when people muse more than one line. Sometimes it doesn't make a difference. Sometimes it does. You know as well as I do, if one person, one end of the boat, and the other person, the end of the boat, one might not be catching any fish at all. And so they move the boat around, they put more lines in, and one person suggests the other one, I'm catching it on a pink glow jig, and they all switch to that. And I really debate the assumption you're not going to take more fish. I think you would take a lot more fish. But and then the other thing about the other states is we've got states, I think, where electronic fishing is still allowed and trot line fishing is still allowed and all sorts of wacky rules, and it can go as far as game and fish. We've got states where you can take 6 deer a day and almost every day. So as far as comparing it to other states, I think that Minnesota is ecologically different than other states, and there's probably a reason that our regulations are different. I'd like the DNR to speak to that, but before we just say that, like we do in a lot of our laws, well, Wisconsin does this, and South Dakota does this, and North Dakota does this, I think it's hard to compare, you know, apples to apples. I'd like to hear what the DNR says about all this. My only concern is for the number of fish we take. And you say the lakes are teeming with fish, and there's never been more walleye. You're right, but there's never been more fishermen, it seems like, or pressure. And we say the angling is down, but it's hard to notice. I mean, the competition is just fierce when you go out there, and that's what I worry about, all those boats out there dropping more lines in. And I can't speak in it with any biological expertise, just watching people fish, but that's why I'm kind of interested in the DNR, if they're just lukewarm or feel strongly both ways, or if they're really going to come out emphatically against it or really don't care, I don't know.
Well, Representative Cornish, it's interesting that you would ask the DNR to come forward, so if Mr. Pyre will come forward, we'll hear from Mr. Pyre on this. Or we have the commissioner, the assistant commissioner, we got the whole house here tonight, so you'd be able to get the scoop from the department.
Yeah.
Go ahead if you'll introduce yourself for the record, and I think you heard Representative Cornish's question at the very minimum.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player with DNR Fisheries. And Representative Cornish, would you please repeat the last question so I make sure I answer that one?
Well, there are several of them, but I'd like your expertise in, can we equate, is it apples to Wisconsin or any of these other states, what they do to our ecological balance in our lakes and our fishery, and is there studies to prove that more hooks or more lines in water take more fish, and do you guys really give a rip one way or the other, or do you feel strongly about it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, we do not have a lot of information in Minnesota, but we do on the Mississippi River. We have information from Big Stone Lake and certainly other states, and it's pretty clear that more fish will be caught with two lines. The concerns that we have is Minnesota's a destination fishery. We're in the top 4 or 5 for non-residents coming to our state. We're in the top 4 for resident angling hours, for dollars spent, for percentage of our populace that's licensed. And the problem we have in this state is what we call quality over harvest. It isn't the numbers of fish. It's the quality. We've got a lot of bluegill. We have a lot of northern pike. But we're very skillful as anglers. Here's one right here. They understand the fish habitats, and they can go out and take those. So our concern is that this will exacerbate the quality over harvest issue that we're facing, which will lead to more regulations and more limits if we want to keep the sizes and numbers of fish that are out there that satisfy most anglers. And that's been the biggest concern we've had, is the home of the quarter pounder. Many of you have heard that. We're also concerned with lakes like Mille Lacs Lake and Red Lake. If we increase the harvest, last summer we were within 15,000 pounds of hitting our cap. And so on those lakes where there's a quota where we have to quit if we reach a certain amount, those type of situations I would guess would certainly push us into that point where we might have to say, no, we're going to have to shut the fishery down or be more restrictive on our regulations over the upcoming year.
Mr. Pryor, one of Representative Cornish's questions, as I recall, was, is there an index or something of success in terms like the walleye limit being, let's say, 6? And do you, when you figure harvest per fisherman per day, do you figure like 3.2 or a portion of that harvest? Is that how you get a grasp on the take
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we use a catch per hour. So when we do creel surveys, we'll go out and we'll interview anglers and see how long they fished and how many fish they caught. Rarely, on average, do most anglers don't catch their limits. And I'll reference 1992 when the big hot bite was on Mille Lacs Lake. 70% of the anglers caught one or zero walleyes. So the limits kind of spread things out, and they keep an over-harvest during the hot bites. But I think Representative Cornish's point was very well taken, that if everybody did take their limit, we'd have a very difficult time maintaining a fishery in most of our waters.
Well, having read the letter on pheasant harvest, and the department's position on expanding to 3 birds after 2 weeks into the season, it would seem to me that we should probably lower the walleye limit to 1 or 2 then, because then fishermen would be more satisfied that they got the limit. Where on the pheasants, you say, well, we don't want to raise it to 3 because then they won't get their limit and they won't be happy. Mm-hmm. I had to bring that up, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions by the members. Representative Moe, sorry. You're just where I can't see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the question I had previously, you know, you have the authority to do this now. You've chosen not to on all but Lake Superior, is that correct? And so, I mean, obviously there's a reason for that. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I don't recall the legislation you referred to in recent years to allow the use of 2-hook statute right now. It does indicate, as in the original language here, that you can only use 1 hook. We do have exceptions on the Wisconsin border waters. We allow ice fishing and on Lake Superior once you get away. So there are some exceptions, and that's where our data comes from. But we have seen catch data from other places where it usually won't be a 2-to-1 ratio, but you might see anywhere from a half to 2 times or even more if your catch rates are low to start with.
Mr. Chair, follow up. And so I must be mistaken. So it must be just specifically border waters. Should we have done that for all Minnesota lakes? Do you think that the DNR would have proceeded to allow 2-line fishing on some lakes, no lakes? Can you maybe hypothesize on that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I think fisheries managers would almost unanimously say no on the 2 lines, especially where there's any kind of pressure. Minnesota has a lot of angling pressure on their lakes, and we've got a few hundred lakes now with regulations to try to retain that quality. So I do not believe that we'd see any instances where we'd see a more liberal or an increased harvest opportunity for our fisheries.
General.
And then the last follow-up question, I also questioned about the second-line stamp idea. Would that be a tool that perhaps you could use should a fishery be its fish and health to allow for 2 lines? Thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, we've talked about that in terms of other species and a walleye stamp in the past. One of the difficulties is with party fishing. If 4 of us were in the boat and one had the stamp, you can kind of move things around a little bit. But the end result is still the increase in harvest. We're already straining at the seams trying to keep the average size of fish up there where at least most anglers are satisfied when they go out. And so whether you paid for an extra line or not, the end result in our minds would be an increase in harvest, continued decrease in average size, leading to more regulations or limit restrictions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Further questions for Mr. Pyre, and then he'll be around some more if we have something come up. You have another testifier, Representative. Thank you very much to the department. Representative Heigerken, your next testifier.
Mr. Chair, he's going to yield this time to Jim, who's got an answer to a couple of the questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Representative Cornish asked about undue pressure on the lakes, and Ron addressed that as well, sir. And one of the things that's most important to realize, and you know, if you were a warden for a long time, you take 25 years ago, if somebody caught a walleye, it was pretty much in the ice chest. I mean, that was it. They were pretty happy with it. And even on Black last year, I saw in the paper, there were more than 400,000 pounds of walleyes kept and 1,002,000 pounds released. And that's significant to understand that in today's age, we've got more education, more information, more skilled anglers, perhaps, and more people willing to catch, like Representative Mo said, you know, maybe one or two fish. Would they be happy with that? In some cases, if they're two, and they're both 16 and a half inches, my wife's real happy with that. But the key about it is that a lot of people are releasing more of those fish, and the BWT, we talked about that, the organization I run, when we started in 1989 on Mille Lacs, we said, Ron Lindner said, we're going to be a catch and release organization. In 1989, people said, how do you do that, and why do you want to do it? That was the question. We really tried to educate the public that releasing fish is important. You see that with muskies, you see it with largemouth, you see it with smallmouth. And whether the catch rate would be higher or not is one thing, but the fact we know is that the people who would probably be using two lines in a trolling tech scenario where they need an extra kicker motor and they need boards and they need rod holders and they need special line and special rods and in some cases lures, those people have a propensity to want to catch fish, but they don't necessarily need to keep all they catch. That's what we're trying to educate people about, in addition to the ability to use two lines. So I wanted to respond to you, sir.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Heigerkin, your next testifier?
This would be, we just came down for support, so I think we're okay.
Okay, very good. Questions by the members? Doesn't appear to be any Mr. Meyer, anything further from the department? That meant you didn't have to come down.
Chair members, I'm just going to be really brief. The best way, if you want to fish with two lines, is just to take a kid fishing with you. So we can do fish with two lines right now.
Okay, that's it?
Yep.
All right, members. You were brief. I'll renew my motion to... Or did you have the motion on that? Representative Hagbarth renews his motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Thanks, sir.
The next bill up will be House File...
1021. House File 1021.
Who said this one?
All right, House File 1021 is a bill that I authored, so I'm going to pass the gavel over to pardon me? Okay. Kate, would you like to come here, please?
So I need to know my motion. Mm-hmm.
Since we got a few testifiers, I'll stay here and leave some room up there. Okay, Madam Chair, my motion on House File 121 would be to lay the bill over as possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill. That is my motion.
Okay. Representative Doe?
Madam Chair.
To your bill. Representative Hepler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Doe, I know we voted on the last bill. I'm not sure that we really need to vote on bills to lay them over for possible inclusion. I don't know if you want to start doing that or if we want to talk about maybe not doing that. I don't think we have to do that, so I would just recommend that we don't.
That's actually custom and usage.
Right.
That was my error.
Would that be okay then if we just hear the bills and then lay them over for possible inclusion rather than
vote?
I'm just worried, Mr. Chairman, that we do take a vote and then we vote it down.
Yep.
And then we don't have a chance to include them later.
What about if you would ask for reconsideration, and then we will just lay the bill over as you suggest?
Well, I think that one you know, is laid over, and I think we're okay on that. But I'm just wondering about some of these other ones that are coming forward now.
Yeah, we won't take a vote. I'm sorry.
Okay,
that's custom usage of the body is to do that, or the committees is to do
thank
that.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam.
You got a rookie chair.
No, I just want to, I didn't want to probably take a vote on your bill, Mr. Chairman, and it fail or something.
Yeah,
we can't bring it back.
Almighty, I don't know what I do. All right, members, House File 121 that's before, 1021 that's, Madam Chair, can I go ahead with the bill?
Yes.
Okay, House File 1021 that's before you was a bill that the DNR brought forward to Senator Bach and I, mainly because of the legislative intent that was given to them in previous legislatures, I think dating back into the 80s and 90s. We'll hear from the department on that, to end any commercial harvest of game fish in Minnesota. However, as I understand it, in that instance, they did not deal with lake trout in Lake Superior, because that has always been a commercially harvested food fish as well as a game fish. So they brought forward this bill that would, in fact, do exactly what I opposite of what we want to actually accomplish with the real bill. And so with that, I am before you is an amendment. It's the H1021A1 amendment. It should say delete all amendment, and then the rest of it will be as written. So the bill would end up to be the 1A1 amendment. So that is my motion, Madam Chair, to adopt the 1A1 amendment.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dill, do you want to incorporate that amendment into your bill?
Yes, I do, to adopt it into House File 1021. Delete, yeah, delete all.
So, repeating Representative Dill's motion to move House File 1021 as a delete all amendment, H1021A1. All in favor?
Discussion.
All right, discussion to the amendment. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dill, you want to get the bill on the sheet that you'd like to start with, right?
That's
then we
true.
Can discuss it. So you'd like to, I think we should vote on the amendment, get the bill on the sheet that you'd like, and then we can have discussion.
Very fine.
So we should move the amendment and vote on the amendment.
Okay.
You've moved it already. Let's vote.
Yep. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? The amendment passes. Now, discussion to the bill as amended.
Well, Madam Chair, we have some testifiers here that came down from Grand Marais and have been very patiently waiting nearly all day. And I'm sure we have someone here from the department as well to testify. So if you'd like to give your name and who you represent, and if you could give the committee your take on how we actually got here today with this bill as amended.
Okay. I'm George Wilkes. I'm from Grand Marais. I run the Angry Trout Cafe there. I've been associated with the North Shore Commercial Fishermen's Association for several years. I'm here with Steve Dahl, who is an actual commercial fisherman from Duluth Township.
I'm president of the North Shore Commercial Fishermen's Association.
And we consider it a pleasure to be here. We haven't minded waiting. We really appreciate being heard. How much of this do you want me to go into? I mean, I can talk about commercial fishing for quite a bit.
Please need to know how we got here, how you went through the planning process and all of that. Some of the history about the fishery and the cultural part.
Okay. I think at issue here is the DNR is questioning the legislative direction that has been provided, and we actually like the legislation that's already been around for a long time. It's 97C.835, and it basically directs the commissioner to license commercial fishermen for the taking of several species of fish, one of them being lake trout. That legislation exists and has not been changed for many years for a very good reason, and that is because commercial fishing along the North Shore is a very good fit for North Shore communities and for the North Shore ecosystem. It fits biologically, it fits environmentally, socially, and economically. As you know, commercial fishing has been it's been at the heart of North Shore communities for about 150 years. And so it's a very important cultural heritage in our communities. But it also still exists today as a very vital part of our towns. There's an existing commercial fisherman like Steve here. It's just a wonderful little industry. It's owner-operators working out of small open boats, 20 to 30 feet long. They're catching lake herring, and they also do assessment netting for the Department of Natural Resources for lake trout. So there's some lake trout being caught. And they supply local markets along the North Shore, restaurants, fish markets, with really high-quality fish. And they are supplying the local food that is growing in demand. You know, the demand for locally produced, healthy food is really, people are becoming so much more aware of that. So this industry is really something that's very important to our communities now, and we feel that it has potential to continue to be important and to get better. The commercial fishery, it provides fish to people who don't sport fish. Anybody listening to me here? This is amazing. It's also important as an economically as an industry and unto itself, even though it's a very small scale industry. It fits well with the North Shore, and it is important to us. We do employ people. And it's also very important to our tourism industry, which is 80% of the economy on the North Shore. And commercial fishing really provides that authentic tourism experience and character of place that's so important to our tourism industry. I mentioned the local food connection and the cultural heritage. A little bit of a history. Commercial fishing, again, been around for a long time. In 1940, there were over 400 licensed fishermen from Duluth to Grand Portage. Today, I should have mentioned this earlier, there's about 22 licensed commercial fishermen. There was a invasion of sea lamprey in the 1950s that collapsed the lake trout fishery, and that was the most important fishery at the time. The state closed the commercial lake trout fishery in 1962 to protect the remaining lake trout stocks. And the good news is that after 45 years, the lake trout have really come back. There are now wild populations of lake trout reproducing along the North Shore. Hopefully you've gotten some of the information that I provided to you about what the population is estimated at and what the harvest levels are at this time. This population of lake trout supports a robust sport fishery throughout Lake Superior. It also supports a commercial fishery in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ontario. And the sad truth is that most lake trout served in restaurants along the North Shore are actually imported. They come from either Wisconsin or from Canada. Because the since 1962, the commercial fishermen along the North Shore are still not allowed to fish for them. So our position here is that we have a wonderful opportunity to reopen this commercial fishery in a very sustainable, very conservative way. Because there's actually enough fish, especially in zones 2 and 3, which are the northernmost zones, to support both a limited commercial fishery and a thriving sport fishery. I mean, we really have a unique opportunity here where the lake trout are actually underutilized in much of the Minnesota waters of Lake Superior. And that has been determined by the DNR's own fisheries biologists. Okay, the latest chapter in this story is that in 2005, the DNR was rewriting their fisheries management plan for Lake Superior. And as part of that, they created a citizens advisory group. And that included sport fishing groups, commercial fishing groups, environmental groups, and tribal agencies. We met, I was a member of that group, so was Steve. We met for about 18 months to help the DNR rewrite their fisheries management plan. As a result of that process, there was a proposal made to take advantage of this underutilized resource of lake trout on Lake Superior. And the proposal was for a very conservatively managed, small, modest amount of lake trout to be commercially harvested in zones 2 and 3. And that was really quite a wonderfully crafted agreement. I mean, here we had a citizens advisory group consisting of sport fishermen, commercial fishermen, and other interests. And we actually got the approval of all those groups to go forward with this proposal. I will read you some of the sport fishing groups that approved of the limited commercial harvest of lake trout. Arrowhead Fly Fishers, Duluth Charter Fishing Guides, Kamloops Advocates, Lake Superior Steelhead Association, North Shore Charter Captains Association, Trout Unlimited, Two Harbors Catch and Donate, United Northern Sportsmen, and Western Lake Superior Trollers. These were sport fishing organizations that were on this citizens advisory group that were involved in rewriting this fisheries management plan and that approved of the proposal to commercially harvest a small amount of lake trout. I think that's a remarkable accomplishment for the Lake Superior Department of Natural Resources office to have created such consensus around something that's, you know, usually so contentious. Unfortunately, that was a draft version of the plan, and when it went to St. Paul for final review, the proposed lake trout harvest was removed completely. I guess I'd like to say in closing that the one thing to keep in mind is that Lake Superior is inherently suitable as a commercial fishery. It's very large. The lake trout are very deep. It takes quite a bit of money and effort to sport fish on Lake Superior for lake trout. And commercial fishing is a great way to access that fishery. And that's why less than 0.1% of Minnesota anglers fish in Minnesota Zone 3, and also less than 0.1% of Minnesota anglers fish in Zone 2. And that's why there are the lake trout fishery is underfished, because it isn't a terribly nice place to fish for all but about 8 weeks out of the year, whereas commercial fishermen are able to go out and harvest that resource for the consumers of Minnesota.
I guess in line with that,
I said, didn't I, Stephen?
Representative Dill.
Mr. Wilk, I have a question for you. As my recollection of the history is that at one time the assessment fishery was as big in numbers of fish as what this bill proposes, or thereabouts. And why, if that is the case, why is now there less assessment fish being taken than there was back in the 80s, when I think the population has been climbing since the 80s on into today? The population's been going up, but the assessment's been going down. There must be a reason for that.
Okay, the lake trout population has not actually been increasing, but it's the percentage of wild fish relative to stock fish that's been increasing. And that's a part of the indication of the recovery of the species. Now, back in the 80s, this assessment fishery was done by the DNR to assess how the lake trout population is done, and it's always been done by the commercial fishermen, at actually quite a bit of expense to the commercial fishermen. Since 1962, commercial fishermen have gone out and assessed the lake trout population for the DNR. Back in the 80s, there were about 12 assessment fishermen, and the harvest in Minnesota Zone 3 was about 3,500 fish. Over the years, as fishermen have retired, the number of assessment fishermen has dropped to about 4. So now the assessment harvest in Zone 3 is about 1,200.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dill.
How about died?
Usually that's the case.
Not only do they retire, but they really check out.
The phrase is, died with nets in the water. That's what you're shooting for.
All right.
Do we have a second testifier? Do you want to state your name for the record?
My name's Steve Dahl, president of the North Shore Commercial Fishermen's Association. George is pretty much giving you the whole story. I can say that I fish on Lake Superior starting the end of March till Christmas, and well over half of the time, I'm the only one out there in my district. You know, the pressure just simply isn't there. And I'd also like to reiterate that all the restaurants up and down the North Shore have commercial fishermen close to them, yet they're calling the Wisconsin commercial fishermen to deliver them fresh lake trout. It's just simply not an equitable situation. And it, you know, and as George has said, the demand for local food, organic food, has grown so much. You know, and what we're asking for is sustainable, and it's bioregionalism at its best. Locally produced food. So, I don't know, are there any other questions?
Representative Dill?
Could you explain to me where MN3 and MN2 and where that would begin and end in terms of on the shore? And so if members could think about the Duluth, starting at Duluth and ending up at Grand Portage, kind of give a description so, and where MN1 is to start with.
Okay. I fish out of Knife River. That is in MN1. This, I won't get any benefit from this at all. That goes from Duluth to Encampment, and Encampment is northeast of two harbors. Encampment River, I'm sorry. And then the next zone is MN2. That goes from Encampment to just South Cascade River. That would encompass Silver Bay, Beaver Bay in that area. And Cascade River is, again, southwest of Grand Marais a bit. And then from there, that is MN3 is to the border.
Representative Dill?
Yeah, I know you won't have a scientific, but you'll have a observation on this. How? What is the difference in hook and line fishing, sport fishing, in MN1 versus 2 and 3 in terms of people doing it?
Yeah,
Mr. Will sort of testified to that.
I don't have an exact number, but the sport fishing pressure in MN3 is almost insignificant versus in 2, there isn't as much. MN1 has probably 80-some percent of the pressure, sport fishing pressure.
That's it.
Again, that's because it's so close to Duluth. And again, that's why they're not going to allow me any commercial harvest of lake trout in that district. So.
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for making the trip. I was up in Grand Marais yesterday, and it was a drive. Beautiful. Yeah. You know, it seems like a fairly insignificant, manageable number of fish. I wondered if you could comment on how that relates to just across the border in Canada. What's the fishing amount, commercial fishing amount allowed up there, and how does that compare to what you'd like to do?
I'm not certain about Ontario. I know that it's probably a larger number, and in Wisconsin, I think that the total allowable catch for commercial fishermen of lake trout is 16%, again, which would be
far greater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that the total harvest in Wisconsin is, I think it's around 100,000 fish, and they have a little different situations in there. They have quite a bit more habitat. And I think of that 100,000, the tribal gets about 50%, and out of the other 50%, so about 50,000 fish, about 16% of that, which would be 8,000 fish, would be to commercial.
Thank you. And I'd be interested in getting the agency down here.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify for or against this bill? I'm assuming the DNR, Mr. Meyer.
Could I add one thing?
Mr. Lowe?
Yeah, we're here on behalf of the North Shore commercial fishermen, but in a way we really feel we represent North Shore communities. And we've got letters of support, which Representative Dill has, from Cook County, Lake County, the City of Grand Marais, Town of Lutzen, Town of Toffee, Town of Schroeder, City of Beaver Bay, and the City of Silver Bay. And we're scheduled to appear in two harbors in a couple of weeks. So we really, and by the way, in all those resolutions, we lost one vote. And that was because I pressured him. I came in late. I didn't give him information. But anyway, it really is along the North Shore. It's there's a lot of support for the commercial fishing industry.
Madam Chair,
Representative Dill.
Well, what does the resolutions all say? I mean, you said you had resolutions, but what do they say?
I could read you the one from Lake County.
Well, just no. Tell us what they say. I mean, they must say something.
They're in support of commercial fishing of the commercial fishing industry. And I didn't say that, huh?
Nope.
And in
specifically in support of a limited commercial lake trout fishery, the reestablishment of a limited commercial lake trout fishery.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe while Assistant Director Meyer is coming down. Representative Deal, the one thing I'm trying to figure out, why are we on line 1.6 changing the number of commercial fishermen from 50 to 25? Because that doesn't that affect all the different fish that these gentlemen are fishing for?
Madam Chair.
Representative Doe.
That was a part of the stakeholder group DNR decision that Mr. Wilkes described to lower the number of total fishermen through this plan that was draft that then didn't get adopted. By and large, I think, because of the lake trout part, but Mr. Meyer can testify to that.
Yep.
But that, I think, I'm told that's a kind of a peace in the valley thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. My comments initially are just going to focus on the bill as was introduced and talk about a little bit about the amendment and specific questions I may have to bring up Mr. Pyre. But the bill that we had drafted and introduced reflects the direction the legislature has been giving the department for many years. In the mid-80s, the legislature, with the DNR, bought out the commercial fisheries on the Ontario border waters. Since then, and we have not had any commercial netting of any game fish within the state of Minnesota. The bill before you today reflects that intent that the legislature has given the director, the direction that the legislature has given the DNR to continue moving forward with, to have a handle on the commercial harvesting
Chair,
of game fish.
Representative Dill.
Well, I want to make a correction. You said the bill that is before us today.
Yes. The bill that was introduced did contain that prohibition. The amendment now does allow for the assessment harvesting, but we aren't talking about commercial harvesting. I mean, we're talking about assessment harvesting that can be sold. So our main concerns are allowing for that commercial harvesting of lake trout. You'll see the language that you do have here that Representative McNamara spoke of dealing with the commercial fishing licenses. You need to have a commercial fishing license to perform the assessment netting. So what this bill has and what Representative Bill is trying to do is craft some kind of workable solution perhaps, but our biggest concern is the direction we've been given dealing with the elimination of commercial harvesting of game fish. So just I want to make sure people understand that as we talk about the fishing pressures that we see and the management of our lakes, management of our border waters, protecting those game fish that we have are our number one priority. So yeah. With that, members, I can stand for any questions.
Representative Bill.
Back in the, Mr. Meyer, back in the 80s, wouldn't, if the intent was to eliminate lake trout commercial fishing, wouldn't you have changed the statute then, referring to lake trout, in exactly what the original bill does that was presented to me to be introduced?
Mr. Meyer.
But instead the legislature didn't choose to do that.
Madam Chair, members, perhaps Mr. Pyre can give us a little more light on that issue. And as I mentioned previously, the Lake Superior lake trout harvesting has been done under assessment netting, not under commercial fishing. But you do need to have a commercial harvesting license to do the assessment netting.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative Dill.
Mr. Meyer, if this bill were to just go away and not become anything, would assessment fishing continue on Lake Superior?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, yes.
So the only thing that the bill does, as presented today, is expand the number up to what is believed in the plan that was drafted by DNR and with the stakeholders to a higher number of fish. And I'd ask then, Madam Chair, Mr. Pyre, one of the questions I'd like to ask is what is the sustainable estimate of fish in MN 3 and 2? And so how much of the sustainable amount does this bill propose to a harvest?
Madam Chair,
Ron Pyre, DNR Fisheries. Madam Chair, Representative Dill,
I'm not sure the exact number, but I would think that the numbers that are articulated in your bill now would be in the 15 to 20% of sustainable harvest estimates.
M. Chair.
Representative Dill.
I think I heard that number as being a similar number to the Wisconsin catch as well. Did I hear that from one of the testifiers, Mr. Wilkes, maybe? Mr. Dahl?
Yep.
Well, you have a comment on that, Mr. Carr?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, Wisconsin has 10 operators. They're each allocated 1,000 fish, each 1,000 lake trout. Michigan doesn't have any non-band lake trout harvesters, and Ontario has a mix. They're trying to buy out their lake trout, the non-band commercial lake trout. But I think the numbers are in that 10 to 20% range of harvestable surplus.
Representative Moe?
Madam Chair, just Mr. Parr, could you comment a little bit more on what's allowed in Canada? It seems that based on your comments that Canada is trying to move in a more conservative direction, is that true? But still their numbers that they harvest are far greater than this would be, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, yes, I think Ontario and Wisconsin certainly have much higher lake trout take than we have. And I think because of the take for First Nations, that they're trying to eliminate some of the other harvest just to keep the pressure off the stock.
Representative Dell.
Mr. Pryor, Madam Chair, is there any biological reason why that we wouldn't increase, why the state wouldn't increase the assessment numbers?
Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, we don't need any additional fish for assessment purposes. And the question came up before, why do we need less fish now? And we have more years of data and our models are better. So when we looked at that, we don't need the additional fish. I think the biological risk of this number of fish would be very minimal, but not non-existent. And I say that because we're facing things like viral hemorrhagic septicemia, a really nasty viral disease that will be coming into Lake Superior probably in the near future. Lamprey wounds are increasing. We're unsure at this point in time how long the Grand Portage Band harvest of lake trout will continue at the levels that they're harvesting. And it seems like we get invasive species coming in to Lake Superior on a monthly basis. So I'd say it's a fair statement to say that taking this number of fish, the additional numbers that are proposed have very minimal biological risk at this time, but not non-existent.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Pryor, do you have presently the ability to reduce or stop harvest of a fish presently, whether it be hook and line or by netting or otherwise? And doesn't lines part of line 2.6, 2.7, and 2.8 readdress that issue when it says, and I'll just paraphrase it, lake trout populations are managed the effects of invasive species or fish disease? So, I mean, I think that the bill as drafted re-recognizes, I think, your already existing authority. So could you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, we do have existing statutory authority to protect the resources. So if we saw a problem, we would have the ability, pardon me, to restrict fishing, and this certainly clarifies that.
Do you want to renew your motion? Are there other questions by the members? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go quickly, Mr. Pryor. I wanted to follow up on your lamprey comment about more lamprey wounds, because I believe I had heard that there was some resistance to the lampricides, or that there was less response to the pheromone treatments. And if you could just highlight that a little bit.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson. Yes, there's been an increase in lamprey wounds. Treatments in general have decreased a little bit, and there has been some adaptation to the chemical TFM that's been used. But the main issue is that the efforts to control have been reduced. And we've seen an increase in lamprey marking wounds. That's one of the things we can get from anglers and from our assessment netting is what percentage of lake trout have a lamprey wound there. And we've seen those numbers going up. And so as you look, we've put an allowable harvest on lake trout for Lake Superior. And in MN3, we're under that right now, but it wouldn't take a huge bump to go up there. But we are seeing an increase in lamprey wounds.
Representative Hansen?
Just to be sure then, so it's more a question of dropping the treatments or the effort on management rather than any resistance or lack of work on the pheromones.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that that's correct, that it's a measure of effort that's being applied to lamprey control.
Any other questions from members? Representative Cornish?
Representative Dill, Madam Chair, from what we've heard, it sounds like there is going to be minimal impact from your bill on the fish population, and even if there was, that they could stop it if necessary, and that the community is in favor of what you're doing. Is that correct?
Representative Dill?
Well, I thought that was the case, and when they sent the draft plan down here for approval, final approval, as I understand it, Mr. Meyer and Mr. Pyre could comment on that. Meyer and Pyre, you guys are a team. It ran into a wall because there has been this previous direction from the legislature that I contend had to do with walleye and not with lake trout, and certainly not Lake Superior. It had to do with what lakes, Mille Lacs, Lake of the Woods, Rainy Lake. I don't even remember the lakes. I wasn't in the legislature then. I was just catching them at that time. So, I mean, I think that's what we're trying to clarify, and frankly, the reason I introduced the bill, Representative Cornish, Madam Chair, that the department put forward is so that we could actually start this discussion so that we had what the DNR thought their direction was and they were trying to implement and what this direction that you described the bill and what it does accomplishes so we could have that very discussion. I thank you for the question.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify?
Meyer.
Madam Chair, just on those questions specifically. The report did talk about expanded assessment netting, but it did mention a little bit about a pilot commercial harvesting program. Our concerns are establishing a commercial harvesting program will then bind the state's hands to doing some buyouts or some kind of other dealing with those kinds of issues if we do have to shut down the fishery in the future. Precedent is everything in this body, and as we've bought out those other commercial fisheries to protect the habitat or the fish, if there was a commercial fishery established on Lake Superior, then that would basically bind the DNR's hands, which we would have to come back and get funding for to do any commercial buyouts in the future. The assessment netting that is in this bill, Representative Cornish members, is a direction that certainly you have the authority to put in place. We wanted to have exactly the discussion we're having tonight in front of the body. Make sure people understand commercial netting, assessment netting, historical context, and the intent that we've been given, the direction we've been given. And then, like everything else, it's up to you to give us the direction. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like possibly a sunset would be of some value. And the other thing, I'm curious, this is probably a question either for Representative Dill or one of the two previous testifiers. The big talk was the restaurants along the North Shore would like to sell Minnesota caught lake trout. Do we have any idea how much lake trout the restaurants along the North Shore would use? And I'm wondering, you know, if we should be do this for a few years, would a sunset be of some value? Either my questions, either for the DNR or for the author.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dill.
Well, in the bill, Representative McNamara, the bill, as I understand it, the fisheries management plan for Lake Superior covers a period that actually sunsets on December 31st, 2016, 8 years from now. And if that's incorrect, the DNR can comment on that. The bill on lines 2.9 and 2.10 and 11 state that the quotas must be reassessed at the expiration of the current 10-year fisheries management plan for the Minnesota waters of Lake Superior, dated 2006. So not only do we have the cautionary shock absorber, so to speak, of the department having in current law the ability to regulate the resource, also the language that we put in the bill to give to further assure that it pertains specifically to the Lake Superior lake trout, we also have a sunset of sorts in that the quotas will be revisited when the plan expires. And they could go up, they could go down. And that's a risk that the commercial fishermen will have to take if this bill were to come law, and those that oppose the bill, if there are any, would be taking.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Mr. Wolf?
About the amount of fish that the restaurants use. I have no idea what the total amount of fish used on the North Shore would be, but I think the 3,000 fish in Zone 3, a couple thousand fish in Zone 2 would make a significant contribution to local fish being served on the North Shore. It would have to be well over 50%, something in there.
Thank you, Mr. Will.
Madam Chair?
If no one else to testify for or against, would you like to renew your motion to?
I've had one more comment.
Okay. Representative Dill.
This bill, Senator Bach and I were brought into the loop on this thing back in well before session. I don't remember even what month. But, I mean, we had a meeting with the DNR and the stakeholders, and we discussed and hashed this all out. Since then, I have systematically worked this in the media. I've had it in Outdoor News. I've had it in Minnesota Public Radio. I've had it in the local papers all along the shore, some article in the local papers as well as the Mesaba Daily News. I have received four emails, one in support, one with a suggestion, a further suggestion, and he was a part of the stakeholder group, and his suggestion was never taken up during the planning process, so it's something he thought of afterwards, one for and one against. That is the communication that I have had on the bill. And unless there's questions, with that, I'll renew my motion to lay House File 1021 over for possible inclusion. Representative, oh, I'm sorry. I got an amendment. I need to do an amendment. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, before I do make that motion. Members, to get the bill technically correct, Mr. Helen has advised me that we need to delete lines 22, 23, 24, and on line 25, insert after section and period 2. And that then will get the bill properly numbered and get the conflict out of the bill as amended. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and then I will renew my motion to lay the bill
over. We need to vote on the amendment first. Is there any?
I just want to incorporate that amendment in my amendment.
Okay.
Well,
then we got to vote on that. Mm-hmm. We got to vote on that.
Okay. Yeah. We already adopted the amendment.
Okay, so we need to vote on it.
Yep. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Amendment prevails.
So now I'll renew my motion, Madam Chair.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dill. Just to make everything clear so everybody understands, everything that is on the original bill, Representative Dill made a motion to this amendment was going to be a delete also. Nothing on this House File 1021 is in the bill anymore. And all the language in the A1 amendment has been adopted with the exemption of the last amendment that we just adopted to delete those lines. So I just want to make that clear, Representative Dill, that this is what we're working on now. And that's what we'll see when we go to put the Game and Fish Bill together is engrossment of this amendment.
Let me make sure I'm doing that right with Mr. Helen, if you give me a second.
Right.
That's correct, Representative
Madam Chair and Representative Dill. If there's going to be any changes to this, you'll have an amendment at that time to change this when we put the Game and Fish Bill together.
Madam Chair? Representative Hackbarth, this is a bit of a work in progress.
Right.
I mean, we've been negotiating even as this meeting's been going on. They've been, we've been going back and forth. So it's getting closer, and we've got, what, a couple of weeks before deadlines, and if there's another amendment, we'll bring this forward again.
Thank
and,
you.
And re-amend it.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Madam Chair, I just wanted to make that clarification just so everybody knew what page we were on here.
Thank
you very much.
Representative Hackbarth. And we will lay over House File 1021 as amended for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill.
Okay, let's take up the forestry bill next. All right, members. House file 1016. No, I'm sorry, the forestry bill. 631. House file 631. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anzell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
And go ahead. I understand that you have a couple of amendments to the bill. Do you want to do those amendments before you begin explaining the bill? Adopt the amendments?
Yes.
Okay. And the amendments, if you'll give us just a minute to get them here before us. We got the bill. And amendment. And
while you're doing that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is the DNR forestry bill. And
I don't think the microphones are on, so you don't have to.
Okay.
I don't think so, but that's all right.
And I know of no opposition. And as I stated earlier, we have two amendments.
Well, let's take Representative Anzell. Let's
Mr.
take
Chairman?
The.
Mr. Chairman.
We need to move the bill first to bring the bill before us, and then we'll take up the amendments. So I'll move House File 631. And what are we doing with that? And it be recommended to pass and sent to Environment and Natural Resources. Okay, let's try the 0090 amendment first.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the 0090 amendment would go on page 3 after line 25, and it is brought to us by a wood products company in northern Minnesota by the name of Ainsworth, a company whom you probably realize is not doing very well at the present time. And it would allow cash in place of the bond requirement plus interest when sales do not occur. It is relief for the company. And the DNR has tacitly agreed to this language, and if there are questions about it, I would refer you to Mr. Tomlinson.
You know, Representative Anzell, so currently when the companies, not that they have to, but when they buy wood on the auction, they post a bond that's for the full price of the sale. So if it's $100,000 worth of wood, they have a $100,000 irrevocable letter of credit or bond.
That's correct.
What this allows them to do is convert it to a 15% sale, which most of the logging families do.
Yes.
And because they did this conversion, they're going to pay interest on the amount of time that expired between the date they bought the sale and posted the bond and the date they convert. They're going to pay us interest on that. So if all the companies did this, we'd actually make some more money.
Yes, thank you for that spectacular explanation.
I did something right tonight. Okay, questions on the amendment? Mr. Tomlinson, you're before us. Do you have any opinion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. We've said, we've mentioned to Representative Anzell and others that we're supportive of it. Basically, we're just taking those 100% certain sales and making them like everybody else, which are 15% down, and we're fine with that. When we put the 100% thing was in there, really for a couple of purposes. One is that it allowed the industry to take the cash back, the 15% back, and use that cash elsewhere for other sales and things like that. And the other bigger reason is that it also allows the bigger companies more flexibility when they can go in and begin operating the sale, because we require that 100% down right away. This allows them to go in and perhaps begin road work and that sort of a thing. if they change it from the 100% back to the 15%, they won't be able to do that, but that's their choice, and I think they know that, and that kind of the intention with the legislation, too, is my understanding that the way it would work.
Okay, any question by the members here? Anyone to testify for or against the bill? Oh, Representative Moe, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Tomlinson, so just to be clear on this, and I think I have the answer, but just to be clear, there's no fiscal impact to the DNR budget by doing this. And the second question is, not that, of course, we want to, I see the council here, of course we want to support Ainsworth, but there are other forest product companies that we'd also like to help out, or are there other employers in the north that will benefit as well, and maybe you could speak to that, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, to answer your first question, no, there wouldn't be any fiscal impact to it. I guess the fiscal impact would be if they didn't operate on the sales, and we'd be, you know, we'd be out some, but I don't think that's likely. But I guess the other part of your question was, there's actually about 7 or 8 companies that would qualify for this. This wouldn't be just for Ainsworth, but you recall that I testified, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we have $100 million or so of standing timber out there. About $17 million of that is guaranteed with 100% instruments such as bonds or other financial instruments like that. And that's where this kind of comes in. And it's not very likely that all of that, of course, would revert back to the 15%, because all of that wasn't bought at the higher inflated prices during the late in 04 and 05. A lot of those sales go back in 02 and 03 as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. And my last question is, if we don't do this, explain the on-site management challenges then the DNR might have.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, I think the biggest thing is the uncertainty, you know, how those sales are going to get operated on eventually. I think, obviously, they stand a lot to lose if they walk away from them with that 100% guarantee there, but they try and maybe pass those sales on to other folks, I suppose, would be one, assign the sales to other purchasers that could do that. Operate that, but they're still going to be obligated for the entire the bond there that they have down. So I think the implications are pretty significantly onerous to the industry if we don't do something.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wally, would you like to come forward and testify on this? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Kevin Wally. I'm representing Ainsworth Engineered, and we do support this amendment. It would provide flexibility for the company in its timber purchasing. Appreciate the fact that Representative Van Zelk was willing to offer it to his bill.
Okay, questions for the testifier, questions on the amendment?
Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was Assistant Director Tomlinson in there. I was just... put my head down. Let's
want Mr. Tomlinson to come back, Representative McNamara?
I think I do. My question, I'm trying to remember, Mr. Tomlinson, did we do this in 03 that we put this bond deal in? Is this part of, I was thinking I was part of a discussion that I was a big promoter in the bond, and so is this my mess I've created here in the short time I've been here?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, you have a good memory. I'm not sure if it was 03, but it was in the last few years sometime that we did have this ability, if you will, for the industry to put that 100% down.
Okay, and then, and I'm not sure, Mr. Chair and Mr. Thomas, and possibly this is something for counsel, Mr. Helen, I'm surprised that under current law, they don't have the ability to withdraw their bond and just post the cash deposit. Isn't it stated as an either or for them? What makes us think that we have to put in law they don't have the ability to do that now?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the way we interpret the law is that once you have posted 100% down, you've given the intent that you're going to go ahead and it. The sale essentially becomes effective at that time. That's the way we've kind of treated this. And I believe there's language, I don't have a statute in front of me here, but somewhere in there in Chapter 90 that talks about when a sale becomes effective. And we'd have to, one of the things we looked at was changing that paragraph that dealt with that relative to this particular issue. But then Mr. Wally came forth with this language, and we thought it did a pretty good job with it as well. So,
Jim Magner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the intent is because you take, Mr. Tomlinson, you take the deposit they put down and probably invest it in something. That's the idea of the interest, and that's what I'm coming forward to. And then, Mr. Chair, my other question is, well, first, okay, that's pretty self-explanatory. I'm assuming that. Is this being moved to which committee? Because I guess I'd like to have that interpreted, because in normal construction, you'd be able to go back and forth on this, and I'm surprised that we wrote this to where that wouldn't be the case here.
No, Representative McNamara, we're sending this to Representative Eakin, Chairman Eakin's committee, and the interest is a penalty for exercising this right. It may be that you think the intent of what we should have is that they can switch back and forth, but they can, according to what the DNR has interpreted, as I understand it. And so the reason that the interest is in here is a penalty. So let's say that they had the sale for 4 years, and they were obligated for 100% indebtedness on the sale, and now they want to convert to 15%. They then would pay the interest on from the date that they posted their bond, bought the sale, to the date that they converted. Now, if I were a company, I think that, and I didn't intend to cut $70 wood, I would convert, pay the interest, and walk away from the sale. But they can't do that now. Is that?
And you would be walking away from 15%.
15% plus interest rather than
right. The
100%. Okay, any questions by the other members? Okay, anyone to testify for or against the amendment? Okay, I'll move the 0090 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay, the next amendment is the 0089 amendment. Representative Amazell, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This language in this amendment has to do with the Laurentian biomass projects in the communities of Hibbing and Virginia. And as this the situation has been explained to me, there are difficult situations that arise at landings in the woods where loggers are cutting and stacking wood and then setting aside wood tops and ends and so on for biomass. And the language on page 2, lines 4 and 5, I would refer you to. The county board may sell any timber, including biomass, as appraised or scaled, period. And additionally and orally, I don't know what the procedure would be, I would ask the committee to strike the words "at its discretion" as well. So that would be an amendment to this amendment that I'm offering orally.
All right, members, I'll move the 0089 amendment. And then we take the amendment to the amendment, right? Okay, so then Representative Anzell would like to remove on line 2.5, after the comma, put a period. I'm sorry, remove the comma, put a period, and then the words "at its discretion" and the period, remove that in an amendment to the amendment. Discussion on that?
I think it's included.
Everybody understand it? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. And now to the amendment as amended. questions? I had something on this amendment as well. This does not apply. The counties, you see it says the county board may. Some counties are already doing this, as I understand. They're already selling it as appraised.
some counties don't believe that in current law they have the authority to do that. What this amendment or this bill, the amendment to the bill, as amended, will be conclusive evidence to the counties that they can do exactly this. As I said, I don't have the list, but there are counties that are already doing this. And some counties, St. Louis for one, has told me that they are not doing it because they don't think they have the authority. So, Mr. Tomlinson, can you give us something on that? Do you know about this?
Mr. Chair, members, I am not aware of which counties allow it at this point, which don't, but you know, I just see that it provides a little more flexibility there, and it states it, and I guess if that's what the counties feel they need, they have the authority there to be able to sell as appraised rather than as scaled. I don't think, you know, I don't see any reason why, I think that would be a good thing.
Okay, so, Thompson, you are in agreement with the amendment, as amended. Okay, Representative Manziel, any further?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, once again, the purpose of this is to clear up indecision, clear up confusion, especially confusion at landing. We don't want bad things happening there.
Further questions? Being none, the question is on the 0089 amendment as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion does prevail. Now, Representative Anzell, to the bill as amended, House File 631.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I stated earlier, this is the DNR's forestry bill. Senator Saxog and the other body is the Senate author. Going through the sections briefly, sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 create the Forest Resource Assessment Products and Services account, which is basically an opportunity to capture, as I understand it, three pots of money, including federal funds. There would be, there is no fiscal impact to this. It would simply give the department the ability to combine three accounts into one and create this new account where services would be provided to the PCA, the Forest Service, Bowser, county land departments, and other state and national land managers. The kinds of services envisioned here in this consolidated section within the department is survey, data collection, aerial photography, satellite imagery, and analysis of the resource. So that's a very brief summary of sections 1 through 4.
Representative, Mr. Chair, members, actually, that's 1 through 4, and section 7 of the bill actually sets up the Forest Resource Assessment Products and Services account. I'm just going to mention that.
Okay, questions on the bill from the members? And again, we will be... Representative Mull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Tomlinson can respond to this. Section 6, reducing the number of pounds of decorative boughs to be required for a permit. Is this as a result of over-harvesting or need for control? Maybe the operator can speak to that, too.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, thanks for asking. Kind of figured you'd be asking about boughs. Bough gathering is becoming a cottage industry in northern Minnesota. A fee has been required for several years. This legislation would now require a fee for a limit of 25 pounds of boughs harvested in any 1 year as opposed to 100. The department feels very strongly that this harvesting needs to be done in a sustainable way and that there are sound, sustainable practices of harvesting cedar boughs. And so by reducing the poundage down to 25, the department will have a better opportunity to educate and instruct and help more bough gatherers as to how to do it sustainably. And not to kill the tree. As far as the revenue involved here, the department tells me that the additional permits will generate approximately $250 in new revenue, so it's not a major imposition, I don't think. The department figures there will be 10 additional permits, and these permits are required anytime somebody is either harvesting boughs or transporting boughs.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. So, but you said cedar, but balsam, any conifer bough, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Magnemare?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hackbart just mentioned it, too, in regards to this. Mr. Tomlinson, didn't we change this to the 100 pounds not too long ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I believe it was 2001. Would you like a little background? Prior to 2001, there was a lot of unregulated bow harvesting occurring. And there was a lot of concerns by those folks involved in this emerging cottage industry, if you will, I'll call it that, in northern Minnesota, about whether or not balsam boughs were being harvested in such a manner that they would be done sustainably. And so from that concern, out of that came the Balsam Bough Partnership, which some of you may recall, there was some testimony by different folks. It was the harvesters were included on the partnership, the purchasers of the boughs, that the brokers types of folks were included on it, the landowners like the DNR and the counties were included on it, and the wreath and garland manufacturers that are primarily down here in the Twin Cities were included on that as well. And they all agreed that what we needed to do was have a better handle, if you will, on harvesting the boughs, and that there needed to be a couple of things put in place. One was that there needed to be a strong educational component for anybody out harvesting boughs to instruct them, if you will, on how to harvest them in such a manner that they were being done sustainably. So we wanted people to be able to go out and harvest them, not take terminal leaders off, but take the laterals off, that sort of a thing. And as well, they agreed that one way of controlling and getting at any theft-related types of issues and things that were going on relative to where the boughs might have been harvested from and stuff, were to regulate it in the wholesale sector at the purchaser's standpoint. That's why you have the bough buyer's permit in there. And so the legislation was basically passed in 2001, which set this threshold, if you will, of 100 pounds, and it said the DNR shall charge, I believe it was $25 per permit for that 100 pounds, and that we would have these classes for folks. And now what we're suggesting is to take a little bit different approach. We're updating the statute, if you will. And one, we're reducing it from 100 pounds down to 25 is our proposal. The sense is that anybody who wants to harvest boughs for their own personal use, just to make a few wreaths for themselves or their family and things like that, can do that anywhere up to 25 pounds worth of boughs and not have any restrictions relative to it. Anything more than that, we feel fits into that kind of commercial harvesting category. And so that's why we're reducing it. We're proposing to reduce it from 100 pounds down to 25. The other thing we're doing is removing the exact fee from statute and allowing the commissioner to set that statute on a yearly or bi-yearly basis, you know, however, but be a little bit more flexible. And I don't anticipate that that's going to change from $25 at this point. It'll probably stay that way. And then the third thing is to require, rather than the educational type of thing, require the kind of the visit, like we do with timber sales, where we expect each operator to sit down with the forester prior to his permit and understand how that harvest should occur and stuff to make sure that it's done in a sustainable manner. Most of these bow harvesters have already gone through the training probably several times, and it's just a matter of reiterating to that and reinforcing it with them on an annual basis now at this point in a little more detailed long term.
We got first Representative Hackbarth and then Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Tomlinson, I understand that you're saying now that you expect that the cost of this, and I agree with what you've been saying, and I think that's the way it should be, actually. But the wording here in Section 6 concerns me because it says to govern the commissioner's cost of issuing the permit, and I don't know what all that includes. But when you say in conference with state appraiser designated to supervise the cutting, are we going to have someone out there supervising the cutting of these boughs when you give out one of these permits for one of these individuals? I don't think that's your intent. I think that could get pretty expensive if that's what you're talking about. I don't think that reads quite right, or I don't know what your intent there is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, to your first concern, I think we're just talking about the administrative cost of, you know, the paperwork relative to issuing the permit, not personnel time and otherwise for going out and...
Well, I hope that's what you found on, Ms. Thomason, but that's not what the bill says.
Well, that's our intent. That's why the permit fees have been at $25. We don't anticipate changing those to reflect, fee for... our time in the woods, so to speak, for that purpose. $25 isn't going to cover that. And that's not what we intend to do.
And Mr. Tomlinson, on the second question was about, are you going to have somebody out there training these people, a pre-sale conference?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. We want to make certain that those folks that are harvesting boughs on state land that we've done, this permit applies to... Well, this is about buyer's permit, so it applies to all ownerships, I guess. But we'll be, for our purchases on state land, we will be out there looking at the sites and making sure that they're harvesting in the right places and doing it in such a manner that there's no rutting occurring and that they're doing it sustainably and as we've asked them to do it in our pre-sale conference with them.
Well, Ms. Thomason, so... In order to receive the permit, you will have to have that pre-sale conference? So the first permit you get, you're going to have a pre-sale conference?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Well, unless advised by counsel otherwise, it looks to me like that could be about any cost that you decide because, I mean, it says cover the commissioner's cost of issuing the permit. It would include the cost of the mileage getting out there,
Mr. Chair, members, a pre-sale conference can occur in the office. We don't have to be on the site to do that. We could sit down. This might be as simple as taking out an aerial photo with somebody who comes in our office and says, I want to harvest boughs, designating a spot on the aerial photo that adjacent to a gravel road somewhere or something and saying, we'd like you to harvest in this particular area here. Give them the information they need relative to how to harvest the boughs. We have fact sheets and otherwise like that and things. And then give them the permit for it.
I don't think so.
That's the way I see this. You know, it won't be necessarily in the woods marking out boundaries and things like that as we would with the timber sale activities.
Okay, I got Representative Wagenius first. Representative Wagenius, thank you for being patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I've now spent my $25. I've got a permit. We've had a conference. How much can I harvest? Up to what can I harvest? And how much do I have to pay for it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you'd have to pay the $25 for the cost of the permit. And we would designate with you what that harvest would be, you know, as we're in the conference with you, whether it be 100 pounds or 200 pounds or whatever it might be.
Representative Venus.
Okay, well, let me follow up then. What are the ranges? What's the range of what you say somebody can harvest at this point?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, I don't know what the range of the permits are. I can certainly find that out at this point. I don't think there's that many permits that we give out, but I know there's many that are smaller, and then there's probably a few larger operators working out there, and I could find that information out and get that.
So if I'm a larger operator, do I only pay $25?
Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, that's correct.
Well, Ms. Thomason, when I was city administrator up in Orr, an outfit called Mickman Nurseries, I think their name was, Mickman Floral or something of that nature.
Used to be my that's chairman.
And Representative Hackbar's district. They contacted me to get a storage facility for boughs up in Orr. And when they rented the storage, as I remember when they rented the storage facility, this was a huge Morton building that we had. And that thing was, as I remember, was packed with boughs. And it couldn't have been any the kind of numbers you were talking about in terms of harvest. I mean, it had to be a huge, it was a huge amount. And I'm just thinking about the amount of the harvest. Now, also I remember that they weren't the ones that were harvesting. They were just renting the building, and they had individual harvesters that were doing the harvesting. So it seems that those individual harvesters that work for them would get this $25 permit, but I'm thinking about these huge operations that make their living on that. I'm just wondering about the fee and how that's all going to lay out. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Giddens, I'm not sure how much we might be charging in addition to the $25 fee. Suggested to me on Friday as I was checking in with some folks up in Aiken County where there's a fair amount of this done, that it's just a $25 fee. But I need to check a little further than to make sure that I'm getting the right answer to you on that. And basically you're wondering, is there a cost to the operator beyond the $25 fee? Do we have a price that we charge per pound of bowls or something? And I need to find that out.
Representative Manziel to this point, and then we'll go back to Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Living in the woods as I do, I know, I have no knowledge of what happens when the individual permittee in his or her 83 beat-up Chevy four-wheel drive pickup with a box full of boughs. I don't know where those boughs go, and I don't know where permitting and the dollars flow, but I know that I see the same vehicles and the same harvesters typically five or six times in the woods where I live. I don't see three or four harvesters, but I have no knowledge of where the boughs actually go from the permittee.
Okay, we'll go back to Representative Agenius, and when you're complete, Representative Simpson has a question.
Yes, so you got half my question, and half was, do we charge beyond the $25? The second is, what is the range that we allow to be taken? I have no problem with, you know, small folks taking a small amount, but if we have somebody on a $25 permit taking a Morton building's worth, then I think we need to discuss that issue.
Well, I have a question, and, well, actually we have, to this point, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to the question that Representative Genius raises, the people that are, and Representative Anzels knows this, the people that are out doing this, you know, are in a fairly depressed part of the state of Minnesota, which, I mean, they're essentially subsistence gatherers of some of the additional forest products that are available, and in parts of the state which the unemployment rate might be 30% and 40%, this gives them a small window of opportunity to actually raise a little bit of additional income for their families. And Mr. Tomlinson can speak to this too. As long as they're taught correctly how to do this, this is virtually insignificant on the resource. So it's an opportunity for families and many of them very poor, to make a go of it for another small portion of the year. And the big operators really are some community action organizations in Cass Lake and Deer River, which employ people, both bringing them there and then assembling the boughs and wreaths and things during the holidays. So it's actually a very, very positive program in our district. As long as Mr. Tomlinson said, it's done correctly and they're not cutting the terminal buds on the fir trees. So.
To this point, Representative
Hackbar? Correct, Mr. Chairman. And maybe Mr. Tomlinson could speak to this issue. Maybe he doesn't have the numbers. But also, if they're taking this workshop or this class, they're only paying $10, not $25 currently. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But that's what we want to change, just to have everybody under the one.
So pay $25.
Everybody would be required to have that pre-sale conference, and everybody would just pay the $25.
Pay the same amount. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Simpson, you've been patiently waiting.
Thank you, Chair Dill. Representative Anzel, I would just like to offer this as maybe a friendly amendment, and talking with Mr. Tomlinson and in the discussion he's had, it sounds like he intends for this fee to stay at $25. So I would suggest on line 3.6 and 3.7, the annual fee for a permit for a resident or non-resident to buy decorated boughs is $25. Leave that in. And on line 9 and 10, the commissioner shall charge a fee for the permit that covers the commissioner's cost of issuing the permit. Take that out. And I think that will solve the discussion that's been going on here for some time about how this fee is going to bounce around, because it seems like Mr. Tomlinson said the $25 fee is probably what it's going to be. So it might just simplify the whole process.
Mr. Tomlinson, to the proposed amendment. To the amendment.
Mr. Chair,
I
appreciate your interest in it. And what I meant, I guess, was for the foreseeable future, perhaps, like this year, that we don't see the $25 going up. But, you know, I guess the department's not real anxious to have fees set in the statutes where in 4 or 5 or 6 years we need to come back and look for a change in them at that time. If you decide you want to do that, that's fine. But another approach like this might be to just add the word administrative cost in there on line 3.10. So it's pretty clear that we're just charging the cost of the administrative cost relative to the commissioner, not the field time and other things like that, which, they'll just leave it at that. I offer that as an alternative.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a good compromise, and I think we're just trying to come up with a number here, and I guess the only thing I would say is, as I understand the history here, this started in 2001, so I think we've already had that set in place. So it's Representative Anzel's bill, and it's just a friendly comment.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hagmar.
I'd like to move that amendment then. After, between the words commissioner and cost on 3.10, insert administrative.
All right, we have an amendment proposed by Representative Hackbarth on line 3.10 to add between commissioners and cost the word administrative. Discussion on the amendment? Ms. Tomlinson? I guess that was your proposal, so we don't... Very good. Any further discussion? All right, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment does prevail to the House File 631 as amended. Further discussion, further explanation of the bill.
Thank you. The last section of the bill is Section 8, quite possibly the most important portion of the bill. Section 8 is necessary in order to prevent the Sustainable Forest Resources Act from sunsetting. And this is the act, this is a major activity within the DNR for resource management, a whole host of programs and services are provided there, and there is a fiscal implication here. The governor is recommending an appropriation of $1.18 million in fiscal year 08 for this activity and $780,000 in fiscal year 09 for this activity, and this is critical resource management stuff that's done, and this section needs to be reinstated.
Ms. Tomlinson, is this that what this is repealing keeps in law things that a private landowner, a small guy, would come and ask for a forest management plan to be done on his... Explain, it doesn't do that?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, this is basically the Sustainable Forest Resources Act of 1995 was something that came out of the generic environmental impact statement on forest harvesting and some other things earlier on in the 90s. And it basically relates to the Forest Resources Council. Dr. Dave Zemet, I believe, has been over here and testified before somebody's committee. I can't remember who's relative to the Forest Resources Council and the activities that they've been involved with the past year or two and what they intend to do in the future. It also deals with the coordination and development of the site level forest resource guidelines and things that we all follow, and relates to monitoring and of the guidelines and the implications of that, they operate a citizens' concern registration program where if somebody feels that something is amiss out there in the woods somewhere, they can call a 1-800 number, I believe it is, and the Forest Resources Council will send somebody out to take a look and evaluate and analyze. And
well, to that point, it would be like a condition where in boughs where they cut down all those trees?
It could be.
They ripped the boughs off of them and left the trees behind?
More likely it might be something where somebody might think harvesting might be occurring too close up to a riparian stream or that there was some rutting that perhaps occurred that shouldn't have occurred and those sorts of things. And I want to emphasize that these concerns are only brought to the attention of the council. Very few, I think maybe one a year, are brought up. But that's good, you know, and being vigilant about trying to go out and correct the situation and make sure that we know who the operators are and they don't happen again. And it also deals with the Minnesota Forest Resources Partnership, the reauthorizing of that, and several other components that are all listed in there. In that part of the bill that is up for reauthorization at this point in time.
Questions? All right, that should be your explanation. Anyone here in the audience to testify for or against any provision in House File 631 as amended? Appears to be none. Oh, Representative McNamara.
Just wanted to clarify, Mr. Chair, is this going to Chair Eakin's committee? And is there a chance if Mr. Tomlinson could bring somebody back from the DNR that's familiar with the BOW program? And I just think that would be beneficial to us because these folks, when they do it right, it's, as Representative Moe said, it's a great thing, doesn't hurt the tree, it works out real good. And for the most part, Mr. Mickman that you mentioned is a friend of mine in business. I know him from the nursery and landscape business, and they do a good job, and they do employ a lot of people in the far north regions in an area that's very depressed, but the boughs happen to be a good thing for them. And so I'm wondering if there is someone, or if you can get us some information. I hate to see somebody have to drive down from Bemidji or Black Duck, but if you had somebody that you could bring when it comes back, I think
I'll try to get one of the field folks from up in Aiken or Tibbing area, something like that, where there's a fair amount of bough harvesting occurs that they deal with it on a day-to-day basis to come down and speak to some of these questions. But the other thing I wanted to mention that Mickman Brothers were part of the Balsam Bough Partnership as well back in 2001 that put this whole thing together back then. Mm.
So, Representative McNamara, that testimony will add to the administrative cost of issuing the permits.
That's why I said don't bring them from Timbuktu.
All right. So we have House File 630. Representative Moe?
No, I'm sorry.
We have House File 631 before us as amended. Then I will renew my motion to send this bill to Chairman Eakin's committee, which is the House Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. In favor of the motion? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
All right. We are going to do two more bills, members, and then we're going to quit. We are going to do Representative Hansen's bill next, and then we're going to do Representative Simpson's bill last.
And the bills that are left on the agenda, which includes one of mine, we will do at a future meeting when I hope we didn't spend all day on the floor debating amendments. Representative Hagbard.
Mr. Chairman, have we moved the minutes?
Yes, we have.
We did that already?
First order of business. Representative Hansen, if you could come before us, please. And where's he at here, Hansen? House File 1016, Representative Hansen. Would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 1016, and I do have the author's amendment.
Okay, well, let's get the amendment before us. You'd like to move the amendment, did you say?
Move the DE-1 amendment, so to get it in the shape that I would like the bill to be in.
All right. Representative Hansen moves the DE-1 amendment to House File 1016, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the DE-1 amendment, I know this particular bill, House File 1016, and has raised a number of concerns. I've worked with the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Myers here to talk about some of the changes that have been proposed here with the DE-1 amendment that helped clarify the bill and I think address a number of members' concerns. So with that, Mr. Meyer can speak on DE-1.
Mr. Meyer, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The DE-1 amendment you have before you today represents some work that we've developed on this bill related to, as the bill progressed in the Senate Forestry Subcommittee. There were concerns about what kind of wood were we approving, how it's going to be done, what the penalty was, and cleaned up some of the enforcement language. So I'd like to just walk through the bill as it's before you now. Section 8955 deals with contaminated soil in an affected zone. In an affected zone, it provides us the ability to deal with contaminated soil, harboring or which may harbor forest pests. This is just a technical change to this section. Section 2 is where the fire restrictions language actually starts. You can see on line 1.14 it states, after the commissioner issues an order under paragraph B, before the ban or the restrictions will take place, we must develop and publish our order in the state register. So that was one of the questions we had. How will this take effect? What happens if the bill passes before the commissioner orders pass? So the bill will pass, we will do the commissioner's order, and then the restrictions will take place. I will have the draft commissioner's order for you to review before this bill is heard on the floor, so you have that in your hand. You can see actually what we'll publish immediately upon signature. The next piece of it states a person may not possess firewood on land administered by the Commissioner of Natural Resources unless the firewood, number one, was obtained from a firewood distribution facility located on land administered by the commissioner. Two, was obtained from a firewood dealer who is selling firewood that is approved by the commissioner under paragraph B. Or three, has been approved by the Commissioner of Natural Resources under paragraph B. And then paragraph B goes on to state, as we just discussed, that we will publish by written order, the commissioner shall, by written order, publish in the state register, approve firewood for possession on state lands administered by the commissioner. And then this order is not subject to rulemaking provisions under Chapter 14, and 14.386 does not apply. This is similar language that we have in several other DNR statutes allowing us to do things by written order published in the state register. The reason for this is for the swift action that we need to do the approval process. We don't have the ability to go through even the expedited rulemaking process that we could do. So by publishing these processes, the Hollywood will be approved, how it's going to be done, we'll be able to do that, publish in the state register, and those will become effective into law. The next piece of the bill on page 2, you can see that we've tightened up the violation. Is the violation of this section is subject to confiscation of the wood, and then after 1 year, it will be a petty misdemeanor. And actually what that petty, how those fees are established is a panel of judges will go through and set what the actual penalty will be. This language states that it will be no more than a petty misdemeanor. So we do have some input into the development of those fine schedules. Other states that have done this have actually had it as a misdemeanor because they need to come in and have a tool that they can have some teeth on and really enforce what the severity of this violation would be, perhaps. Then you can see the definition section. Firewood, we're tying it to the definition of campfire, which is in statute chapter 88.01, subdivision 25. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's the amendment before you.
All right. Representative Packard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, I think you know how I feel about criminal fines and penalties. And a petty misdemeanor is a criminal penalty. And I would like to, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the wording, and maybe Mr. Hillen can help us on this, but on line 2.2, if we could change that, a petty misdemeanor penalty to a civil penalty, I don't know what the proper wording would be there, but I think we need to, Mr. Meyer, this is a firewood issue, and to have a criminal penalty on this firewood issue, I think is wrong. I agree with doing the language, I agree with doing the bill, but I don't want to see somebody have a criminal penalty on their record over firewood. So, Ms. Chairman, somehow I'd like to change that to a civil penalty.
Okay, well, Representative Guinness has something to this point.
To this point, I would agree with Representative Hackbarth that this is not a place for a criminal fine, and a civil fine would be better. My question to counsel would be, is there an administrative fine that would be even easier that could be applied here?
So, members, can we have Mr. Hillen brainstorm this for a moment, go on with any further questions, and
Sure.
We'll give him a moment to think this over. Representative Guinness?
Yes. The other reason that I'm concerned about a fine is because while there's something noticed in a public published for an order, which I think is appropriate since you're not going through rulemaking, but you know, I don't read the register before I go out camping. Probably Representative Hackbarth doesn't read the register before he goes camping either. So my question is, are you going to provide on every application for a campsite a notice that says no way can you bring firewood to this campsite?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogenius, on that point, we are in the process of updating our website. I believe it will be up and running by the end of the week with highlighting this information. Also, every individual who has a campground reservation will be receiving a mailing from us letting them know what the operating procedures are for firewood. And we're taking an extensive public education campaign. We're getting ready to do that here as soon as possible.
Representative
Guinness. You know, I understand about the extensive public education campaign, but Pepsi-Cola does extensive campaigns, and they have a lot more money than you do. So a more precise campaign, like when you apply for a permit, you agree not to bring firewood, would be much more realistic and lots and lots cheaper. I think we just tend to overlook all the signs. If we obeyed all the signs, there would be no milfoil in any of our lakes and no curly leaf pondweed moving from lake to lake. So it seems to me we have to have something much more direct, much more targeted, to let people know, nope, can't bring the firewood in when you come. And that also means that people will be happier when they come. They were told, don't do this. Without them knowing, they're going to have arranged for some firewood in the trunk of their car, came from their grandmother's house, and they're going to be bad. So I think we're missing a little piece of this puzzle here. Is that a piece of puzzle that you can solve?
Madam Chair, Representative Guinness, yes, and I will be back in Representative Eakin's committee with those education materials for you to see, and perhaps there might be some language we could throw, amend the bill to require us to do that, perhaps. I just need to go back and work with staff to make sure we have all the pieces put together, but I will assemble the puzzle for you.
Prepare your answer to this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if we maybe could move the author's amendment. I do have a testifier who has been waiting patiently from outside, and that we could...
I did, Representative Hansen, move the author's amendment.
Okay.
And we're on discussion, so if you'd like to bring Mr. Fitch forward.
Okay, if we could do that.
We can, actually, if we could just... Representative Moe had a question to this point, and then we'll do the testifier. And I know that he's been waiting patiently.
A quick comment and a point. I agree with Representative Guinness. The only exception is there are many people that come camping in the north that don't actually get a permit. They just camp. You know, there's a lot of public land that, and so that would need to reflect that. Mr. Meyer, or Representative Hansen, maybe you could speak to this too. My neighbor, for example, next door neighbor, sells firewood to the state park and forest campgrounds and in around Bemidji as a business. Of course, cutting it locally. Just specifically, how might this affect them? Is there any specific process or additional process they'll need to go through in order to do the business that they're already doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, we are working we're in the process of working with local sources of wood, traditional and otherwise, people who may want to start selling the wood, to give them or let them know what the approval process will be. The way we envision it to work right now is those local vendors will receive some documentation that they will give to their customers, who will then be able to present that documentation to us at the park. That will be clearly outlined in the commissioner's order, and I should have that draft ready for the committee hearing when this is progressing into the full environment committee. We can review that so you have a better understanding. Our idea is we don't want to be having to inspect every truck of every car, asking people, do they have firewood? They say yes, and say, where you got it from? Here you go, I got it from Representative Moe's constituent or from the gas station in Bagley if they're coming into Itasca. So we'll be working with those local vendors, perhaps within a 50-mile radius or more of the park, that will be able to then sell that approved firewood. We want to make it as simple as possible and make sure everybody understands how it does work so that we don't become confiscating a lot of firewood, that we don't have a lot of people violating the law, make sure everybody knows what's out there, what's expected of them, what's anticipated of them. So,
Mr. Chair, just to clarify then, Mr. Meyer, so the onus will be upon the DNR. My constituents, I have a few of them actually, they'll be receiving notice from you, all right? And they're already in this business, so that won't be a surprise. Okay, thank you.
Chair, Representative Moe, yes.
Well, it's hard to believe. First, we started selling bottled water, and now we're going to start selling firewood. I think it's interesting. Water is worth more than gas. Representative Hoppe.
Well, Mr. Chair, I might have a solution to this problem. If we need publicity, why don't we make this a felony and take the people that are convicted and put them on a chain gang cutting wood?
Now, look, Representative Hoppe,
from all over the place.
Representative Hoppe, to that point, we had Representative Virginius and Representative Hackbarth agreeing on this. I think that's landmark. Territory. So I really don't want you to screw this up.
You want publicity? I give you publicity.
All right. So to the amendment, as amended, that is the delete all amendment, the DE1 amendment.
Okay.
Oh, we've got with Mr. Helen. Why don't we take the testimony? Mr. Fitch, welcome and thank you for being patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Bob Fitch. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. MNLA represents over 1,500 members, including nurseries, landscape professionals, garden centers, and others who grow, design, install, and maintain your outdoor living environment. These family-owned businesses combine to create a $2.1 billion industry. I'm pleased to be here today to testify in favor of House File 1016. I want to commend Representative Hansen, the co-authors of the bill, and the Department of Natural Resources for being proactive on this issue of critical environmental importance. No one is more aware of the potential damage that pests moved by firewood, such as emerald ash borer, can cause than the members of our industry. Nursery growers and garden centers in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana have been forced to destroy millions of dollars of inventory of ash trees that can no longer be sold. Even growers outside of the infested areas have felt the impact of the emerald ash borer. Local growers have dramatically decreased their ash inventories, and the remaining ash inventory has been significantly reduced in value, with demand for ash trees plummeting, our growers have taken a significant loss, and that loss will multiply if emerald ash borer comes from Minnesota, is not contained to a small geographic area. I'll cut my remarks short and just conclude by encouraging you to protect Minnesota's environment by supporting ongoing regulation, monitoring, and education on invasive species such as emerald ash borer. Both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Agriculture play key roles, and MNLA encourages you to support these agencies' efforts.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Fitch at this 9.05 p.m.?
They better be.
Representative McNamara, I always can depend on you.
Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Chair. My question, I think, actually probably isn't for Mr. Fitch, though I know Mr. Fitch very well, as he and I have had a long professional relationship at the MNLA. Actually, my question is for the author or for Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Isn't the real issue here, I'm just thinking of the little guy selling the wood up in Representative Moe's district, or the guy selling alongside Captain State Park that's got the little box, or the girl selling it for $2.50 a bundle. Our issue is not with firewood that originates in Minnesota currently. We do not have emerald, and I will tell you folks, emerald ash borer is unbelievable, and we are way short on this issue. This is going to devastate when it does get here, and it's going to get here someday, and it's just unbelievable how much it's going to cost us, and we should be, but that issue aside, Mr. Meyer, I see a real problem with people going to the state parks. We're going to make them into firewood, cops, and we're just going to, I'm wondering if we shouldn't be looking at this issue more, that it's really, don't bring your wood from the infested states, period. Don't tell all the folks coming to the state parks, currently don't bring any wood from outside Minnesota. Isn't that the issue really today, and isn't that what we should be doing, realizing that begin to build our structure, that if we're going to do it by counties or once it's here in Minnesota, maybe you've already had this discussion, but boy, you are going to have a revolt, I think, especially up north.
Representative Hansen or Representative Meyer or both?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I think if we could try to deal with the interstate commerce, but under the Constitution, it's hard to limit that interstate transfer of firewood. And so what we can limit is look at regulations on the public lands on what comes into there. I mean, we're not stopping interstate transfer here of firewood. And we're not dealing with private lands. We're dealing with a small portion of this, which has a secondary educational effect to try to inform people, because the cost of this is going to be huge when it happens. We've already spent a lot of money on gypsy moth in this state, both on monitoring and detection and treatment. And I think you're aware of the detection and treatment. And I think you're aware the gypsy moth can travel on that interstate transport, whether it's firewood or campers or whatever. So with our menu of tools that we have available, this is one step that we can have. And I understand the concern about this, but, folks may remember Dutch elm disease, and this is going to be greater than Dutch elm disease when it comes, because it'll kill everything. And by the time that all the ash that are there, and by the time that people find out about it, it's going to be too late. So prevention is the tool that we have on this, and there will be inconvenience. But the cost on this, when it comes, is going to be immense.
Mr. Meyer?
Rich already mentioned that we're already seeing the cost, as there's liquidation of inventory and a loss of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, Representative McNamara, thank you for those comments, because this is probably one of the most severe issues that we've faced in a long time. Department of Agriculture is stepping up to the plate to deal with the overall larger issue of some of those other sources of wood coming into the state from other states. So what we're trying to do is deal with where we know that the infestation has occurred from other states, people bringing in firewood into parks and into forested lands. Dealing with it as best we can, dealing with the lands that the department deals with. So that's what we're looking at doing right now.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. And Mr. Meyer, I think you're right in letting people know that if they are from Illinois or Wisconsin or whatever and they have a reservation at one of our state parks, that they can't bring firewood in. I think that's important. I think we should also try to model this after what states like Colorado do in terms of bringing in hay and things like that into their state. I know when we go hunting in Colorado, they make it abundantly clear. There's no one that doesn't know that you can't bring in hay from there, and then you go buy it for $400 a bale when you get there. And I'm not saying we want to do that with firewood, but I think you could somehow broadcast that a little more just in general. I can get you the language. I've got the book upstairs from the Colorado Hunting Regulations. But if anybody's coming here from other states to, whether it's on public or private land, maybe there's a way we can just get it to more people. And if that helps, I'll give you the book.
Chair, that would be well. I'd love to see that because we also need to be putting it in our game of fish and our fishing regulations and also on our resident, on our licensing website. I do appreciate those insights. Thank you.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The premise here is that we can't, because of interstate commerce, deal with this issue. And I'm not at all sure that that is the correct premise. And I would hope that DNR would ask its attorneys, the Attorney General's staff, because when you look at there are health and welfare exceptions to interstate commerce, and this is a welfare exception, perhaps. I think there's a strong argument that can be made here because of what's going to happen if we don't deal with it. So I wouldn't want us to make that assumption without getting a very firm legal opinion that is the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lagunias, I will look into that and get you some information on that.
Representative Ackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of the petty misdemeanor issue in the amendment, I've talked to Mr. Meyer and Mr. Bogus and Mr. Tomlinson. It suggested that maybe we just should leave this for now. And I have the commitment of Mr. Meyer that we will change this along the way. They would like the opportunity to talk to some folks and come up with the correct language to change it, rather than just do it on the fly. I would suggest that maybe that's what we should do, and we have the commitment of Mr. Meyer that that's what we'll do. They'll work on this and bring an amendment in the next committee.
So what you're saying is you're still holding that it should be a civil penalty, and they're going to...
A civil penalty, Mr. Chairman, or an administrative penalty of some sort, something along those lines to remove the petty misdemeanor criminal penalty and to change that, but to come up with the correct
plan. Okay, all the members have that. Representative Lagunias, to that point.
To that point, actually, there may be a very simple thing that this committee could deal with. We don't have to call it anything. We just say, if you bring firewood into a park and it needs to be confiscated, then you have to pay us the cost of dealing with it. We set the price and we just put it in statute right now. We can say, if you do it, then it will be confiscated and you're going to pay us, I don't know what it is, $25 for bringing it in, because DNR is going to have to manage it then. So really this is a question of what is it going to cost DNR to deal with management of stuff that shouldn't be there. I mean, that's basically it.
Representative Hansen, to that point?
To that point, Mr. Chair, I would ask that if anyone's looking at doing amendments to the bill, that they would talk with the chief author of the bill as it moves forward through the process.
Okay. Representative Hackler.
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with Representative Lagunias. I think we should change it to something like that, but still I don't know if we should commit to like $25. Can we just work on it before I get to the next committee, and then
what do you all want to do
with the DNR? Would that be all right with the author of the bill, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hansen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would look forward to working with folks on any potential amendment.
And remember, the next stop is Chairman Eakin's committee. Be the next stop. Okay. Now we have to adopt the amendment, right? So, to the DE1, delete everything. Ms. Tomlinson, you came forward. Did you have anything on this? Good.
to the DE, we're ready to go. To the DE1 amendment, do we have any amendments? As presented, the DE1 amendment. On the adoption, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And now to House File 1016, as amended. Representative Hansen.
I renew my motion, and this would be sent to the Chair Eakin's Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Okay, Representative Hansen renews his motion to recommend it to pass on House File 1016 as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, I just want to let you right know, I want to work with you. There's a bigger issue out there, and that's keeping this ash wood out of here. That's what this is about. This isn't about moving some oak or pine from Black Duck to Itasca State Park. But we need to be prepared, because we're only a year or two away, and we're going to be dealing with it on our doorstep. We're not identifying that it's ash we're talking about here. We're dealing with all wood. And I just would like to work with you, and I hope you're working with the Department of Ag and figuring out what we can do, because it's illegal to move this wood right now, any wood from these areas, any kind of ash wood. They're breaking the law if they bring this wood in, and I can't believe that we can't say that anybody coming to our state parks from outside the state of Minnesota needs to get their wood within a pest-free area and just identify it that way. Right now, that would be all 87 counties, I think, with the exception of, I don't think it's legal to move elmwood anymore. But I don't understand why we're not doing that. I know you've said some interstate commerce stuff, and maybe Representative Wagenius has got the right idea here, but we don't want to get people mad about buying wood from the little... I've gone on long enough, Mr. Chair. I'll work with you, Representative Hansen. We need to fix this, because I don't think this is the right direction.
Representative Moe.
Just very quick to that point, Representative McNamara. Regrettably, most people who are come camping don't know the difference when looking at a log, whether it's oak or elm or ash or all sorts of other types. So thus the more umbrella ban.
To that point, Mr. Chair, but they do know geographically the borders of the state of Minnesota. And currently, none of the wood in the state of Minnesota has any of this stuff. So if it's coming from Minnesota, we don't need to be as concerned. My point is, this is huge. This is unbelievably huge. It affects a number of people in this state in a major league way, because people are already afraid of it. But I'm not sure we're going in the right direction with this.
Ms. Thomason, to that point?
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Representative Hansen.
I'll renew my motion. I just want to comment that this is one piece of the departmental initiative, the governor's initiative. The Department of Ag has pieces. We are in communication with folks. This is one part of that overall multi-pronged effort. So I would ask for your support to move on this and work with folks as it makes its journey.
All right. All in favor of the motion to move this bill, recommend to pass to Chair Eakin's Committee, Environment and Natural Resources, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you very much. One more bill, members. House File 960, that's Representative Simpson.
Thank you,
Representative
Chair.
Representative Simpson, to your bill.
Yes, I would like to move House File 960 for possible inclusion.
Representative Simpson moves House File 960 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is very simple. It's very short and sweet and to the point. I had a constituent of mine who is a grandfather call me and indicated that he has a son who lives in Wisconsin, and his son has two boys that are 12 and 13 years old, and they like to come to Grandpa's place to hunt deer, but his son has indicated that Grandpa has to buy their out-of-state deer license for them at a rate of $135 a piece, and he's quite concerned about the fact that he's finding that we're having trouble keeping our youth in the hunting,
and we're seeing a decline in people, you know, staying in the sport. So he asked me if I would be interested in carrying a bill that would give students the ability to hunt from ages 12 to 16 and pay out of state license, buy a resident license. And that's what this bill does. And basically what it does is it puts it in line with other provisions that we have in the law right now, which is a fishing license at residence fee, and this would just put the deer hunting license in it also. And that, members, is what it does.
Okay, the department, Mr. Bogus.
Why is coming down, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Moe.
Just why Mr. Bogus is coming down, I think it's a terrific bill. We're losing, fewer people are applying for hunting licenses now, and anything we can do to get some more kids into it, that'd be great.
And I'd like to add to that that since I have so many retirees living up in my district, they love to take their grandkids hunting, and because of the way the world works now, lots of them come from other states, and I have had, ever since I got elected, I've had people calling me about this from all over my legislative district. I'm talking maybe close to a dozen different inquiries on why this is. Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair, members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR. Just quickly, given the time, we're supportive of this approach. With the mobility of society now, we hear a lot of interest in this. In fact, Mr. Chairman, you're carrying the department's omnibus game and fish bill, and that bill contains a very similar provision that would allow for youth under the age of 18 to hunt small game or deer at a resident youth fee. So it's very similar to Representative Simpson's proposal. There is some revenue implications here, but we also expect that this would encourage more people. We don't think the young people are going to come by themselves. We think they're going to bring someone with them when they come. And so we do believe there will be some offset to that revenue loss, and certainly it helps to encourage more young people to participate in hunting.
And so, Mr. Bogus, as I remember, the language in the bill that I'm carrying, Game and Fish Bill, that encompasses what Representative Simpson has and goes the next step to include another license. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And it also goes up through age 17, whereas this bill is under 16.
Okay, questions by the committee? Okay. Representative Simpson renews his motion for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill, House File 960. In favor of the motion, aye?
Aye.
No, motion prevails. Ready to get out of here. Now, members on the High Gherkin.
Thank you.
No one wants to vote, no?
You didn't need to vote on that one either.
Yeah. I made two procedural motions tonight that I screwed up on. I want to clarify it for the tape. First off, on High Gherkin's bill, we didn't need to take a vote because it was laid over, and then I repeated it again. So now the third time you guys get to find me and criticize me. So the thing to do was we shouldn't have taken the vote, just lay it over for possible inclusion.
Speak up, Mr. Chair and members.
And this is Ed Warner's members, his last committee. Are you going to the Senate? The enemy?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, my first day in the Senate is Thursday, but the good news, I'll be doing game and fish and forestry issues there, along with energy and capital investment.
All right, well, thank you very much for your service here. You've been around in these committees that I've served on since I got elected, and thank you very much. And don't tell them any of our secrets over there until we get to conference committee, would you? All right, thank you. With that, members, we are adjourned.